morning, ladies and gentlemen. These are informational meetings. This is the House Interim Revenue Committee meeting jointly with Lee Dellum.
The House Interim Education Committee.
Thank you very much. And we have an informational meeting today, which is scheduled to start at 9 o'clock, which was 3 minutes ago. As I saw the gentleman back there huddled around the corner with a coin flipping up in the air and back down again and up in the air and back down again, I knew that there were some high-level decisions being made. Dr. Warner, could we just have you kind of lay out the format for today? Again, we welcome you, and there will be other members coming in as we continue to meet this morning.
Dr. Warner? Thank you, Mr. Chairs. The meeting today is focused on the school distribution formula, and on your agenda, we have really trying to look at it from its origins and intent back in 1991 when the legislature first developed the distribution formula, really in the wake of the passage of Measure 5. And joining us for the first presentations are Jim Scherzinger, who was the legislative revenue officer at the time, and Ozzie Rose, who was with COSA at the time, and talk about the origins and intent of the distribution formula was first formed. Steve Meyer will go through with you kind of how the formula has changed and how it works today, and then we have a series of folks coming in talking about a current assessment of the formula and what issues may be raised by the way it currently works.
Thank you, Dr. Warner. Let me just say this: as I've gone through the school funding formulas. And I recognize that we have a lot of expertise here at the dais with superintendents and principals and other valuable folks. One thing I would alert us to is the fact that there's a lot of acronyms used by the education community. Now, not all of us are adept at grabbing or putting our arms around those, and there's certain names that you've got for various different kinds of formulas. And so if you would be very cautious about identifying those formulas at least once during your presentation, and maybe later if you see me with a very quizzical look on my face again. But I think it's extremely important that we do get the history of what got us to where we're at today as we begin the process of perhaps reopening the formula and examining the disparate parts and some of the things that are 19 years old and pretty adequate, antiquated. So with that, welcome Jim and Ozzy. Who's going to start off? The one with the most gray hair?
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzy Rose. I reside at 1323 Jordan Drive South, and age and antiquated, I don't know what that word is, antiquated don't necessarily go together. That was just a humor. I was around when we first worked on this formula. You may or may not recall, in the 1980s, we had a dozen measures before the people that fiddled with tax reform and or school funding, and all of them failed. In 1987, interim Governor Goldschmidt appointed a commission, an 11-member commission on school funding reform chaired by Bob Bridgley, then with Northwest Gas. And we had 170-some people on subcommittees. I took an 80% leave from my job at COSA and staffed that commission for a year. They had great ideas, all of which went by the wayside over the next two or three years through the political process. Then we come to 1990, and the voters passed ballot measure 9 or 5, and changes demanded. The argument for equity, which had been an argument, but we had lots of school closures and equity issues during the 1980s, what drove all this discussion. And we passed a safety net to stop school closures in the late 80s, but we never did very much about equity. The courts were dealing with it. We had some rulings, but nothing that had forced us to do anything about inequities in terms of resources for kids in schools. Then they passed ballot measure 5, and the arguments for equity became a lot stronger because now most of the money was coming out of the state income tax fund rather than out of local funds. And so a move was made to change how we distributed money to schools. Prior to that time, back in the 70s, you provided about 22 to 27% support for state funds for schools. It got up to around 30, 31% at one time in the late 80s, and then it switched over to almost 70% now comes from the state. And so, that, again, that's just some numbers to support what I was trying to say. But when you move to equity, the issue is how fast. The better-off districts are interested in moving to equity if it means hurting their programs. The poorer districts, poorer resource districts, are saying, hey, wait, we've waited a long time, we need equity now. And most, if not all, states that entered into this issue poured a lot of money into the schools to bring the poorer districts up. Oregon chose to not do that, and we reached our equity through a 10-year or so phase-in of bringing the wealthier, the higher resource districts down and the lower ones up. And so that causes around a set of tensions that are pretty obvious. So the argument is how fast you move equity and how slow. And then the formula itself, we wanted a formula that recognized legitimate differences, and there are legitimate differences, in providing the same education quality to every kid everywhere in our state. And how do you develop a formula that recognizes those legitimate differences in cost?
Ozzy, can I ask one question at that point? Were there, in fact, lawsuits against the state of Oregon or school districts relative to the equity at that particular point, educational equity?
Yes. Okay. And I'm not exactly sure when they got ruled on which one.
I'll talk about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
He's a technician. I'm a
politician.
By the way, I also, as we got into this battle, it's pretty interesting. The superintendents played the lead role in the discussion. They represent, at that time, 300 school districts. And their views reflect the views of their constituents. Then we come to you folks, and there's 90 of you up here, and guess what? Your views reflect the views of your constituents. So we had the same kinds of issues. I just dealt with it within our association meetings, and then turned around and dealt with it in front of you folks. And once I went to a meeting over at Ross, we had about 200 superintendents there, and it was the formula issue. And there was a lot of trouble brewing. I'd heard a lot of remarks about my parenthood and a variety of things. And I went to the same police department and borrowed a flak jacket, put it under the head table, and when I got introduced to the suits, I reached over and put my Delmar jacket on and stood up and said, let's talk about the formula, and it went pretty well. anyway, we wanted one that recognized legitimate differences, and we wanted one that couldn't, the formula, that couldn't be manipulated by decisions of local officials. Because human nature being what it is, that sort of thing can happen. We wanted one to the extent possible, left local control to school districts over their own programs and operations. But the push in the discussion, especially with people sitting in your chairs, hey, if we're providing the money, we need to call more of the shots. Well, we have a whole 200-year history of public schools being run by local communities, and many of us think that's pretty valuable. And to the extent we could say that, it was important. And we coined the phrase, are we going to have a state school system or a state system of schools? And you can have a state system of schools and leave a lot of decision making, but you need to have some mechanisms to cause that happen. The formula captured all the funds, all the local funds. Everything. There was nothing left, and you added some things to it, local option and so forth, but the original thing, all the funds were captured and distributed through the formula. So all districts were treated the same in that sense. The original formula, this is from a document we put out then, looks a lot like the formula today. It had weights for special ed, for at-risk, measured by poverty and ESL rates. At that time, we had Union High and elementary districts. High schools cost more to run, so they had a different weight for high school kids, and elementary had a lower weight if they were just running elementary schools. We had a an allowance for necessary, and then it became necessary in remote small schools. You had an allowance for teacher experience, because if your staff is older, by the nature of the salary steps, they're more expensive. We had a decline in enrollment, which now you guys refer to as the phantom students. But that's a whole lot. We had a decline in enrollment even back when we had only a small portion of the money coming from the state. There's always been a recognition that as schools decline, their costs don't decline as fast as the students do. And so that was in the original. We had a transportation grant. We set the mileage when you have to haul kids. I think it was a mile for elementary and a mile and a half for high school kids. And we said you have to haul the kids to that. You have to haul that preschool handicap. You can use transportation for field trips, et cetera. And we reimbursed it at 70%. And that's pretty much the way it is today.
What was the year of the Individuals with Disability Education Act?
In the 70s, I think.
So it was during your time of meetings on this then?
Yeah. The federal special ed stuff started in the 70s. And in large respect, Oregon had done much of what the feds did before the feds did it. We were ahead of them on that curve in terms of how we were treating the need for special education.
I think someone else can refer to it a little bit later, but I think we're probably also, I think, ahead on the mainstreaming of those youngsters even today, faster than the federal system or the rest of the states.
Might be. The other thing that we did, again, trying to deal with the issue of how fast you get equity. And by the way, we got there over time. We're going to get there in 2 years, but then we come back in 2 years and we do this and we kind of redo it a little bit. We're going to get there in 2 years. It took about 4 sessions, I think, before we're fully on the fund. I'm not exactly sure about that. But the proposal we came forth with at the early discussion that no district could get more than a 25% bump in their total revenues as a result of the new formula, nor could they wind up with more than a 5% loss from the prior year. And the thinking was that a large amount of money suddenly placed in there might not be well spent, and you needed the wealthier districts, high resource, what do you want to call them, they needed some time to phase down, but they needed to get started on it. Well, the minus 5 for those folks didn't last through this building. The wealthier districts objected to that, and they wound up that the range was zero. So that's where the term flat funded came in. The wealthier districts were flat funded, meaning they got at least what they had the prior year, and but the 25% top was still in there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ozzy, where is that in writing? Because I've never heard this one, is the flat funding before.
I'd have to go back and look up the statutes. It's referred to. I've got it.
When would it be reflected, Ozzy, in the formula?
Yeah, right. It's in the formula. So the statute.
If you compare the formula from 96 to 98, you would see.
91, 92 was the first year of the 91 biennium, and we froze everything on the prior year for that first year, and then we started implementing formula in the 92-93 year.
Okay, to follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you. Mr. Rosen, I don't understand. You're saying that right now a school cannot get less than they had the year before, but then get more? Is that what you're saying?
No. When we implemented the formula and the move toward equity, we said run the formula, and then we put a constraint on the results saying, notwithstanding what the formula delivers, you can't have more than a 25% increase in total resources, nor can you have less resources. Again, that was to phase the equity thing in. And I doubt that that's not still in the statute.
No.
That was during the phase-in.
During the phase-in question. And there was 1 year in 93-94 where everybody took a 5% cut.
Yeah.
So it was a flat funding except for that 1 year where everybody lost 5%.
Was that responsive, Representative Wisnan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll do some on the side ask. I still understand. So it's not in the formula now? I guess
no.
I'm like...
Excuse me.
It's my understanding that that flat funding, Paul, you have... There's a... What page is the...
Mr. Chairman, Steve's got in his overhead presentation.
I'll wait, Mr. Chair.
He's going to kind of go through that chronology, but this was during the phase-in until 9901 is when we've reached the point where the distribution formula guides the total distribution now. There's no constraints that affects that outside the formula.
And that gives rise to this issue of the phantom students, and we will touch on that during the
speech. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Awesome. And the other thing I would add is that the phasing concept was driven by how much can you change the wealthier districts in terms of reducing what they have, and how fast can you increase the poor districts? That's how do you phase that in, and that wasn't a mathematical issue. That's a political issue that you applied mathematics to, and that was those were the choices. Subsequent to that, and I'm sure that Steve's going to do this, every session we tinkered with the formula. And it's driven sometimes by the total resources. As Jim just pointed out, one year everybody took a loss from the prior year. That was because of the total resources. But all the proposals over those years to tinker with it that were designed to improve the formula generally favored the districts of the people making the proposals.
That's a shock.
The role we played in that arena, first at the superintendent's committee level and at your level, was to try to balance those interests and make some decisions that were best for all of the schools, all the kids in the world.
Question. Was anybody happy with that?
Well,
you can't come up with it.
I didn't get shot. No, seriously. Everybody looks at their own budget and their own problems and is uptight about that. But I think that an awful lot of people thought, given the total picture, they weren't that unhappy with it. Now, your fast-growing districts said, we're not getting a fair shake. So we need to do something about that. And that was an issue every session through the late 90s. And the argument over whether fast-growing, the districts who aren't fast-growing point out that you get more students, you get more money, and da-da-da-da-da. I'd rather be fast-growing than stagnant or slow-growing. But everybody had to argue it from trying to put their budget together. And again, we didn't pour, notwithstanding all the publicity about how much costs have gone up, we didn't pour tons of new money, and we replaced property tax money with income tax money, but the overall contribution was not a huge growth in funding for schools over that period of time. And it's difficult to rearrange those budgets to meet the new constraints.
Representative Flores, it's good to have you here. Thank you very much, Chair Flores. You can go ahead and yield that gavel for a while. This is mostly educational information, so we're here.
Where do I start and with whom?
You got a much heavier gavel than I have. Weeny gavel, so you got the big one there. So.
I'm done.
You're done. Well, thank you very much, Ozzy. Questions, follow-up with Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ruzz, when the formula was created, I've been told the past history was it was known that it was, because some of the statements in here talked about and things I hadn't seen, that it's now equity is achieved, so the formula is okay. I thought the position was it was temporary. We knew it was going to be compromised in getting there, and we had to make some changes. And my other question to you is, when it was when you came up with it in the 1990s, how many schools had declining enrollment? Because where I'm going with the question, if we have so many with declining enrollment now, it's a norm. And we're finding something that's a norm, not an exception. I think when we started with the formula.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think there was... there was the phasing period, da da da. But I think the people that constructed the
formula, I believe that the concept of the formula, driven by weights and so forth, was a legitimate concept and a way to distribute money equitably and fairly. Now, equity is in the eyes of the beholder. To your specific concern about the decline in enrollment, in terms of numbers of districts, there are a lot of declining enrollment districts. That's true. But the issue of declining enrollment is you lose 28 kids across the district. You don't lose enough at any grade level to reduce a teacher. You don't lose enough on any bus route to stop running buses. So the problem is still there, no matter what, if you've been declining 2 years or 10 years, you've got to adjust spending downward, and you can't do it overnight. And that's the philosophy behind the declining enrollment concept. So it's not a norm in the sense that everybody does it so we can just ignore it. The issue is for District X, if they're declining, their budgeting process can't overnight change with the loss of the students, because they don't lose enough of them to make some changes to cost us.
Jim, let me just say this too, Ozzie, that although I didn't represent Baker County at the time when they lost the mill and Unity, that school went from a little over 100 students down to 50 or 60 students almost overnight. And it was to pay off the teachers' remaining salaries and to the unemployment and the other costs relative to those teaching positions to move those teachers out of the community was I understood from one of my constituents in Magner County that talked across the line in Unity, it was pretty severe. So there were ongoing costs when they shut down a mill in a mill town too, and I think that were, those were some of the issues that were addressed. Jim, you have a
comment? I was just going to address the sort of general part of that question, and that's just to draw this distinction. The 91 session adopted the formula, and that formula defined what equity was in their mind. And they phased that formula in over time, over a roughly five-year period, say. And so once that phase-in was completed, then you could say, yes, we've achieved equity by that definition that they adopted. And actually, the definition changed a little bit over that period of time. That doesn't mean that that definition is equity. Your opinion of that might be different than the opinion of the people that did it at the time. And I think a fair statement would be that when we did it at the time, we realized that we were basing it on perhaps not as much research as we could, and therefore it was not temporary in that, it's sort of not temporary, but that more work really needed to be done to better come up with a standard of equity. But that's a legislative issue. You'd have to do that and define it in order to change the formula's definition of equity.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Woodland.
Mr. Chair, my question to Mr. Rhodes was the historical aspect. I'm prepared to re-question concerning the current assessment of the formula, but I thought that was later in our agenda.
I think it really will be, and we can get back to that. The Chair recognizes Representative Dallum.
Ozzie, one of the things that I'd like to have you bring out, or Jim, either one of you, is at this time, equity is not just something we're striving for in Oregon. The whole nation, funding scheme after funding scheme around the nation, was tumbling to dust as a result of court decisions. And Oregon at that time wanted to be ahead of the court telling us how to do it. So when we say equity, and there were people whose nose were out of joint, that club of equity was a lot bigger than just an attempt to reach equity. We had the court behind it.
Because this is, I think that slides into what I was going to talk about. Unless you want to say something.
No, I was just going to say that the only thing I said earlier about that the move from state, from local funding to primarily state funding, gave stronger support for the equity argument in the courts at that time. I said that part earlier. I agree.
You know, I think that sort of segues into what I was going to talk about. So why don't we move to that, especially given the time. My story really begins in 1975. And in 1975, the legislature commissioned a study, and this is the, I pulled this out of the LRO library, and I think it's the only one that still exists. This was the study, and it was done by Pierce, Garms, Guthrie, those folks. And for people who are economists that know about this field, these were some of the most famous economists in this area in the country. They commissioned to do the study, and what the study really did, it I think documented in unequivocally the kind of the disparities in the Oregon system at that time. At that time, it was fairly common for some school districts to spend twice as much money per student as others. There was huge disparities in spending for schools across the country, across the state. And in fact, there was a court case that went all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court that claimed that was inequitable, and the court found that it was not. And the reason, and this is probably oversimplifying, but essentially the reason they found that it was not was that this system was a system that was created by local control. That the state had established a uniform system, which is what the Constitution requires, and that the disparities were caused because individual communities voted and paid for more funding for their schools than others did. And that was constitutional. Those inequities were okay under that kind of system. So, as I said, this study documented the disparities, and the legislature over that whole period from 1975 through 1990 was working on this issue. It was kind of a constant thought process that was going on. I came to the legislature, working for the legislature in 1978, which was right after that, and this study had developed the first model for this funding formula at that time. Of course, that was computers were just being used for the first time in the legislative process at that time. And the other interesting thing is that many of the staff at the Legislative Revenue Office that was there, which was created in 1975, that same period, were still there in 1990. Steve Meyer, actually, is still here today. And he's been here before I was there. And I came in right after that, and a couple of the others that were there during this period were still there in 1990. And so both, and of course you know that membership, there was not the turnover in membership like there is today. And so a lot of the members were really conversant with these issues at the time that Measure 5 passed. And so when Measure 5 passed, well, let me do one more thing. In 1989, Oregon, 25% of school funding in Oregon came from the state. In 1989, right before Measure 5 passed. That was the second lowest in the United States. The average across the whole country was 48%. So we were a very locally funded system. And when Measure 5 passed, what it did was reduce school property taxes. That's essentially what it did. And shift that responsibility to the state. So you could say, and I think many people point this out, is that state funding as a share of total school funding rose over the phase-in period of Measure 5 to about 70-75%. So that politically, right away, you get this sort of incentive to equalize funding. If all the money's coming from the state, then obviously the legislative process is going to try to equalize that just politically. But what was even more important, I think, legally, and that's, I think, where your legal question comes in, is that the legislature realized right away, they were very conversant with these issues and the legal foundations of them. They brought in an expert, John Augenblick, from Colorado, who's still, I think, a school funding expert today. You can pay a lot of money and have him come out again. And they brought him in, and the conclusion was legally obvious. What Measure 5 did was, over a 5-year period, forced school property taxes to the point where you had no choice as to what your school property taxes were. Everybody was paying $5 a thousand. And you had no option. There was no local option. There was no local option to raise more money. And under the, if you read the court case that was found before, you essentially undermined the foundation of that court case. There was no local control, not local control, but no local choice about taxes, no local choice to fund more than someone else. The foundation of that court decision were undermined, and the legislature went into that session convinced, they didn't need a court case to convince them of this, that they had to equalize funding. And in fact, I don't think we had a court case until we adopted the phase-in period. And what was litigated in that court case, which actually was never found against the state, was the timing. Not the conclusion, but the timing of the... My experience, and I think you can talk to Steve or others that were here at the time, is that there really wasn't a question about equalization. We were going to equalize and adopt a formula. And the only question was what we were going to do and what were the factors in the formula, what would the formula look like. And the legal significance is not just that the state is providing 75% of the funding, but that the formula, because there is no local choice about local funding, that the formula actually allocates all the funding, not just the 75% state funding, but it takes into account how much local funding is raised, and it equalizes that. So it's actually controlling all the funding at that time. Now, since then, because of Measure 50, we have a local option again. But in that period between the two, before we had Measure 50, the state was determining the total operating funding with, you know, a few exceptions like athletic fees and stuff like that, the total operating funding of every school district in the state. And the legislature was very conscious of that. That was something we talked about a lot, that you are now determining the funding of every district, and they don't have other choices, at least by the time you get through this phasing period. So the other interesting thing about that time is if you look at the membership of the committees over most of that period were pretty much where we had a lot of members from Portland area and Washington County. In a lot of ways, when they were adopting the formula and they were looking at some of these things, a lot of times their own districts were the ones that ultimately were going to be equalized. And yet the legal requirement was so obvious that they knew they had to do it. And that the argument was essentially about the phase-in and how quickly we were going to phase in. So let's see. Local control. Ozzie talked a little bit about the sort of the principles, and I know Steve will talk about them when he talks about the formula, so I'm not going to hit them a lot. I'm just going to say that when Ozzie talked about preserving local control, essentially how the formula does that is by allocating the dollars in a lump sum so that even though there are factors like special ed or ESL and that those determine the dollar amount, there is no requirement that those dollars be spent on those things. And that's the preservation of local control, is it's a lump sum amount. We're trying to hand out the money in a way that sort of accounts for differences, but not to change their decision about how the money is spent. So that the notion being that if they have educational goals and they don't need all the money that's allocated for this particular thing to get to the goals they have there, they can use that money for something else. That they need that incentive to be more efficient in their educational program, and so they need more freedom over how to spend the money, and that they ought to be accountable for results. The other thing that happened at the same time, exactly 1990, was the first Oregon school reform legislation that started setting out goals, academic instructional goals for schools. And so the notion at the time was that the formula should not drive the instructional goals and that districts ought to be accountable for achieving those goals and not have to have a separate accountability that you spent your money in a particular way to achieve those goals. You ought to have that freedom. Now that's the judgment they made at that time. And that's the logic that underpinned their formula.
Representative Woodsman is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair.
Okay, you stated that we're not taking away local control, we're giving them a lump sum money, but we're here today, we're discussing the school distribution formula. So do you see a disconnect between the fact that we give all these different categories extra money, but then the school board is not required to spend that money for that? This is philosophy, you know, your opinion about your view of that, because we're talking about the school distribution formula. So we go to all this thing of giving the extra rating, but we give the school board a lump sum, and they don't have to spend it for that purpose. They were given extra money.
And I'm going to talk more about this when I come back later for chalkboard, but I would say I don't see a disconnect in the sense that the real question is what should schools be accountable for and how should they be accountable. And if you have an effective system of holding them accountable for educational results, then why do you need a separate system that tells them how to spend their money as long as they're achieving the results that you want? That would be a kind of where I'd be, but I was saying.
Mr. Chairman. Earlier I said that we, in the construction formula, we were trying to identify legitimate differences. And we do know that it costs more to help some kids than others. There are legitimate, but we didn't want a formula that told you how to, it's not a spending formula, but we did want to recognize legitimate differences. If you have a high percentage of certain populations, it's going to cost more to bring those kids to the same level. But we didn't want the legislature creating a spending formula and trying to determine here how you should spend money in a local budget. And the special ed thing, for example, in Florida, at the time we did this, Florida had 17 different weights just inside of special education. And so you allocate, if this kid has this kind of problem, this kid has this, and you get a different weight. And it opens the door to manipulation and for making decisions based on economics rather than program needs. And so we chose, and at the time, the average cost of special ed was about twice the cost of regular education programs. That's where the 2.0 comes from for those kids. And Jim is correct in that how much research was there. Some. Was it enough? Don't know. But I do know that in the early 90s, at one time, we did a study of Eugene, and they were big enough to do the study and so forth, and they had absolute 2.0 was absolute for them. Now, the smaller the district and the different proportion of kids, or the bigger the district, that would vary. But the philosophy behind it was it does cost more. How much more? We're about this. You get this much money, but you decide what programs will meet your kids' need. And that, you hear now that, you know, and even in Jim's presentation, money allocated for this, it's not allocated for ESL. The ESL measurement is one of the measures that determine the total pot. And it's not designed for deciding in Salem exactly what programs you ought to have in every school district. And you hear the argument, spending formula versus distribution formula.
Thank you, Roger. We'll come back to that again, too. Representative Comp is recognized.
Thanks, Chair Butler and Chair Flores. Ozzie, but is there... Now, this is just, you know, my brain's not as focused on schools as it was at one time, but did not we place a cap on 11% for that double funding for special ed? And if we as a legislature did that, why wasn't there consideration in some of the other areas? What's the history on that?
There is an 11% cap, and there's a board you go before. If you have a higher 11%, you can get an adjustment. Don't know why the issue never came up in other areas. To my knowledge, I don't know.
Yes, I can talk about it a little bit. I mean, maybe if I just went on, I can.
Okay. Before you do, could you recognize Representative Dahl?
Ozzie and Jim, at the same time, 1990, we had the Oregon Education Act coming into play, and it's clear that we did not want to match education performance with money allocation. How then when we look back at that time and that reform movement, we wanted the best educated kids in the nation by 2000 and the best educated in the world by 2010, and we wanted everybody to have a work experience. Was there discussion on how the legislature would be assured that those things happened? Because they haven't. If it wasn't the money, was there any way that it was going to be, was there any sort of an incentive or a hammer? Did the legislature discuss that?
Well, there was a little bit about the legislative process. The way the legislature set this up, quite clearly, was that this question of adequacy, whether there's enough money to achieve the goals that we have, was not an issue for the Revenue and School Finance Committee. That was an issue for Ways and Means and the Education Committees. And they did, and that's still true to this day. They determine the total level of funding within the budget. And the Revenue and School Finance Committees, is what we called them at the time, determined how the funds were divided. And so they were the committee that determined equity. So the legislature created a very clear distinction between those two decisions and put them in separate places. Now, in the school reform package, there was a provision that said that, sort of basically said that if these things aren't funded, you know, they don't have any effect. But that was part of that package. It wasn't part of any discussion that we had around the formula, because the formula does not determine the total level of funding. It only determines how the funds are divided. So, I don't know, Osme.
That's fine.
So there was
a discussion, and it was in the school reform discussion, and there was a specific provision in the Act that said that these things don't take effect if they're not adequately funded. And
follow up, Madam Chair. So there was no provision that the state had to ensure that at that time the press was on to make us the best school system in the nation. But there was no carrot or no hammer or no stick or anything. It was just assumed that it would happen. Or was there discussion?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
We set a goal.
Right.
And if the goal was met, we all celebrate and set the next set of goals. But if it was not met, was there a discussion as to what would happen if we didn't meet these goals?
There, I think initially at the time, and Oz probably worked on this more than I did, there we had provisions for a report card. In other words, that your achievement had to be reported publicly. But that was really the only, if you want to call it hammer, that if you didn't achieve the goals that you want, that the state had set, that was that information was reported and get published in the paper, that sort of thing. Ultimately, when Congress adopted the No Child Left Behind Act, then you had a series of, and that sort of overtook the process, and that created a set of arguably sort of not well targeted disincentives or penalties if you didn't achieve.
Thank you.
That's what I'd say.
Thank you, Madam Chair. From my perspective, there was a large discussion about the issue that was just done. In fact, statutes passed, and a lot of money spent. Quality education model was put into statute as a explanation of the kind of money the state needed to spend to get to the goals that were set forth in that act. And still exists, isn't that true?
Yes, and I think, though, I interpreted the question as asking, you know, what provision was there that said if you don't achieve it, you know, something bad is going to happen to you.
But on the converse side of that, there was a great discussion in this legislative body about what it would take to get there. And in fact, spent a lot of money developing a model that said, if we really mean to do what we said, here's what we're going to need to spend. And an obligation by this body to explain if we don't spend that, why. Isn't that true?
I think that's true. It was not in the Revenue Committee or in the formula that discussion occurred.
Right. Mr. Chair, the other part of that, what I'm saying is, that discussion came down the line because nobody was answering the question Representative Dillon was raised. We made noises about the best the world quality by 2010, but that was said, but there was no way to measure or talk about it. down the line, you said, okay, and one of your the ex-speaker, this was kind of his idea. We need a model to determine what does it take to do that. And that's what, but that didn't come along until
97, 99,
exactly. It was, but it was much later. Lack of an answer to President Dunn's question that drove that.
It's really in two separate tracks entirely. You know, the Revenue Committee would be down in F working out the formula, and I don't know where they were, D or something like that. They were doing the school reform, and they were doing it at the same time.
Representative Dollinger, Representative Compton.
Well, looking back and looking at the two developing on separate tracks, if we were to do it again, would you recommend we put the two together so that we have some notion, the right hand knows what the left hand's doing?
I wouldn't say that, because I think it is fundamentally a question of how you want to hold schools accountable for results. And that isn't necessarily a finance question. But I will talk about what a formula should look like in an outcomes-based system when we, because that's what Chalkboard did. That's what we did in Chalkboard, is we looked at that question. And I will talk about that at the end of the day, so I'm not going to talk about that.
That's Representative Compton. Just a comment, Chair Flores. It's interesting that when we talk about accountability and school funding, that I don't know if my colleagues know that, but the federal government did not ask any state for any accountability for 30 years. Only when we went into a global market, then the word accountability, finally our Congress people said, well, what are states doing with our money? They knew what we were doing with our money for special ed, because that was closely monitored and allocated. But, you know, it's much like the question that's happening in Oregon now. People are saying, well, what are we doing with our money? So it's been a long time coming.
Thank you, Representative Compton. Before we transition, unless you have some wrap-up comments, I would like to close with a question. The formula enacted in 91, based on information that's provided by school districts in various categories, gives them additional funds. And by the very nature of the formula, school districts are not obligated to spend additional funds in the designated category that they reported in saying that they need additional help. Ozzie, you said that you wanted, the intent was wanting the formula that couldn't be manipulated. So my question is, I think in another way to ask the question that Representative Wisnett was getting to is, does not this set up a system where it's potentially some perverse incentive to manipulate the system to obtain additional funds,
that was the best one.
Even though they might not be targeted to the area that we're now saying they need to be used?
I love that question, because that was the rest of my talk.
Okay.
I think you have identified exactly the question that the committee was asking itself when they adopted each of the factors of the formula. And I think their conclusions that they came to in each of the areas varies, depending upon the sort of what data was available or what information they could use to create the factor. So the success at achieving the goal of being totally independent of the action of the school district was achieved more in some areas than in others. So, for example, the poverty factor, which is 25% of the census measure of poverty children in your district. That's an example of an area where they completely achieve that. I mean, the school district has virtually no ability to influence the number of poverty children that live in their district, according to the U.S. Census, because they don't classify them, they don't do the statistics, they have nothing to do with it. And so they adopt, that one gets closer probably to achieving that goal of total neutrality or independence than any of the other factors in the system. Now there is, because there are problems with that data when you get to really small districts, because it's based on sample size, and you get to the tiny districts and the sample isn't large enough, they substituted in the free and reduced school lunch numbers. They reallocated the countywide census numbers based on the school lunch numbers. Well, now, you know, you're a little bit moving into the area where now they might have some influence over it. But nonetheless, that factor probably gets closest to achieving the goal of total independence. The special ed factor that that Ozzy talked about, they explicitly went to a double weight and avoided the Florida-type classification system because they didn't want to create incentives for districts to classify kids at a higher level of disability just to get more money. They saw that that was happening other places, and they didn't want to do that. And you have to realize that this formula is now allocating all the funding, and formulas in other states were allocating much less of the total amount of funding for schools. They're not allocating all the, now we're allocating all of it. So we're putting, we have a mathematician, I'm a mathematician, I mean, in college, and to adopt a mathematical formula to determine the total funding of all these districts is a pretty amazing thing. And if you really want to think about it, and to adjust for all the differences. So anyway, they went to that simple, a double weight, and on the notion that, well, that gets us kind of close, but, you know, some districts are going to spend more and some districts are going to spend less, but we, you know, if we do this classification system, that we, you know, it's going to create more problems than it's worth. They did put that 11% cap on that particular formula because what they were afraid of was that even the double weight was too much of an incentive and that districts would start finding more special ed kids, and so they'd have 15% or 18% of their kids special ed, and so they put the cap on, and they said if you have more than that, then you have to go down to the Department of Education and you have to ask for more money, so you had to come in and justify it. Well, what happened over time, interestingly enough, is that, and it happened across the country, not just in Oregon, is that that percentage rose, and to the point where virtually all districts, not all of them, but most of them, were at that 11% cap. And so what that meant was that the factor really wasn't doing anything anymore. Everybody got a double weight for 11% of their kids, and it just made the per student factor go down, and everybody basically didn't reallocate any money. Now, the only thing that really reallocated anything was this process at the Department of Education of how much they're going to give you because you, this district versus that district, because they have by some measure, they have a different problem than the other one. And that's where all the variation came from. And so it kind of shifted the power of the formula away from the factor onto this determination at the Department of Education, to the point that a few years ago, the legislature moved to a high-cost special ed allocation to try to really pick up the really high-cost kids. So that's sort of how that morphed over time, and it's another good example. I do think there was a fair amount of work at that time into the double weight, in determining that double weight. I think there was more work on that than there was on some of the other factors. The ESL factor, I think a flat out guess. I think we asked John what the reasonable range was, and he told us, and we picked the middle, if I remember. Steve may have a better memory of that. The transportation factor was one where we just sort of threw up our hands. Oregon is such a complex state in terms of the differences of geography and distances across the state that trying to come up with a model for, I mean, we talked about coming up with a model sort of like, who has the model? Virginia? One of the states in the South has a model where they, density factors and all this other stuff, and we talked about it, but we just never could figure out a way to do it, and so we just made it, in sort of the worst case, a percentage of what you spend, which was the way the factor worked in the old formula that we had prior to Measure 5. We did change it somewhat, but the logic of it was essentially the same. And it's still an issue to this day that creates a disincentive to saving money on your transportation because, you know, you just end up giving most of it back. I think we talked a lot about a cost of doing business factor. We had interim committees on it. I think we had Paul do a study of when he was in his other role, of, you know, what factor would we use if we did it, and the recommendation he came back with was the state of the technology of making these estimates wasn't enough to really base a formula that's allocating billions of dollars on it.
And we, excuse me, we spent $125,000 on a study to get at that. And as soon as we got the results, we declared you can't do anything with it. And people ran from it like crazy.
And so there's a there are political issues to that. I think the technology is a lot better today in this area, but there's the political issues are still there. So what was the last? Oh, the small school factor. I think the other factor that we did at the time was a recognition that because of the geography of the state, that you had many schools that simply were less efficient economically because the kids were so widely dispersed. Long distances to travel to school, so you had to have smaller schools, and it cost more to run a smaller school. And we did some work at the time at what those costs were, and in fact, after the initial formula, we adopted that initial formula, we did another further study, one of those interims, and redid those numbers. The other interesting thing that happened to that is at the time we adopted it, we called it the necessary small school. And what?
And we changed it to remote.
We changed it to remote.
They call themselves now necessary and remote.
Right. Well, but the notion at that time was that the necessariness came from distance. That you may have, and you have to recall that at the time we did this, we had a lot of small districts in the state. That one of the other things that happened over this period was state law that forced districts to merge. And we have many, 200 districts today. We had 350 or something at the time that Measure 5 passed. And the other thing that it did, by the way, in that same area is that it caused us to create ESDs everywhere in the state. And it caused us to create a lot more community colleges in the state because now essentially they were being state funded and equalized. And we were really unequal in community colleges. Some places had them and some places didn't. And so that was the impetus for the creation of community colleges in Jackson County and lots of other places in the state. So, but having said all of that was that the notion was a necessary small school so that you had to be so far away from another high school or another elementary school, even if it was in another district. And so you had small schools in small districts that didn't get any money because there was another little district next door and a school close enough that that they didn't qualify for the small school factor. And particularly in high schools, you have now changed that over time so that even though they are closer, they still get the additional funding.
Thank you.
So that notion of necessary has sort of changed over time.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had the small schools talk to the for the people in revenue, who's got Larry and Scott. We had the small schools come in and talk to the education committee, I guess the select committee last week. I mean, those are really dedicated people, and they have unique needs. But you talked about politics and not being able to make some of these decisions. As a mathematician, could the formula say, could be created or changed so that at some point we take the politics and the emotion out and say it doesn't make sense to have this school? Because that's a question I continuously ask Mr. Rosen and some of the other small school principals. You know, who's going to make that tough decision? You know, is the school there to support the community or is the school there to support the kids?
If math cannot do that. You define what equity is. You have to define what you believe equity to be.
You know, we just had one student school district in Brothers, and it took them 2 years to close that. And how much were we paying for that one student, for that school district?
I mean,
it's a very emotional thing, and so help us. I mean, how can we?
Madam Chair, President Wisnett, when we mentioned that we went from 300 plus, I think it was 307 that we had in 1990. We had 350 back in the 50s, 60s.
Okay.
But if we went from 307 to 198. And we did that by forcing all school districts to have a K-12 program. So that required all the elementary districts to join with their high school. Because we had as many inequities within a Union High district as we did across the state often. Our association, with myself as the target, led that effort in this building. Everybody else ran from it.
and we a nexus of stars hit just right. We've been on it, working on it from the 70s till the early 90s. Shirley Gold, Senator Shirley Gold, was chair of revenue in the Senate and thought it was a good idea. Mr. Campbell became speaker, and he thought it was a good idea, and we just all of a sudden able to force the unification argument. But it was very, very difficult. And I told all your colleagues at the time that this is one step. The next step is we need probably a lot of smaller districts to be merged into larger districts. But that is a decision I don't want to be here to help you make. Because you had a tough time. Because the next step is doing away with high schools and forcing high schools together. And that's a bigger issue than when you just force the elementary school in. So it is a political decision. There isn't a math that's going to solve it for you.
Madam Chair, I don't think that's exactly correct. It's the school board, the local school board, even the Department of Education, I don't think has a role or governance and to do that. And I don't think we do.
But you can establish the principles and the funding formula that is the framework in which that decision is made, so that you can say, unless this school meets a particular principle or particular standard, you're not going to pay any extra to that district. And then it's still their decision. If they want to take away from one part and spend it on the other part, that's their decision. That's the way the current decision-making structure is. Now, what I used to tell the members of the committee way back when is that, and the numbers are different now, and I think, what are the numbers today? This is a $5 billion system. This is a of schools in this state. And it has, I don't know how many employees, thousands and thousands of employees. And you are, in effect, the board of directors. And if you're running a business that large, you're not making micro decisions, and but what you are doing is you're setting out the principles and the standards and the accountability that all of the system has to answer to. And that's a judgment you have to make as to how to set that system up. You know that you're not going to set up a system in which you micromanage every decision that's made. But you're going to create a system under which people are accountable, and people aren't always going to make what you think to be the right decision. I remember one time we had a legislator who was really upset that a particular school district had set out a priority for budget cuts. And the last priority, I mean, the first thing that was going to be cut was the soccer team that this legislator cared about. And was really upset that, how can I change this decision? Well, you're not as a legislator. I mean, you can go down and argue with the school board if you want, but the legislature is not going to decide whether there's a soccer team at this particular school or not, I would hope. And that's just the position you're in.
An equally difficult and controversial conversation, ongoing, long going from probably time immemorial, is the high growth question. And I think I read somewhere in our material or background information that at one point then Governor Kinshaber had indicated that high growth districts are covered in the formula, and in perhaps this is transitioning into how it works today and blending a little bit with the history. But is it your view or understanding or intent in all of this morass that high growth districts are compensated within the formula?
The one thing we did in the formula at the time was to make it more current. The old formula that the state had was a reimbursement formula, so that you had to actually spend the money for a year before you ever got any allocation from the state for that spending. So districts that were growing were kind of on a lag system. Well, that was okay when that wasn't a big portion of your funding. But when we went to the new system, we brought everything current so that you got paid based on the number of kids you had in that particular year. So if you had growth, you got an increase that year, ultimately, and the balance at the end. I think beyond that, if the question becomes, if you're a high growth district, do you have higher costs than other districts? And I think there are two sides to that argument, and you have to kind of work your way through both sides of it. And part of it is, part of this issue is that on the capital side, we're still a locally funded system. The state has really no financial role in the capital side of the of this. And so you've got a essentially a system where the a very bifurcated system where the operational stuff is determined by the state and now somewhat local option, and the rest, all the capital side is totally local. And I think that causes problems. I think it creates some incentives and biases in the kinds of issues that you raise that really take some careful working through to resolve.
No. The formula is for the operations of the school, and in that sense, the high growth districts are probably compensated okay
per student
because they grow. The issue for the high growth students is they grow so fast they've got to do buildings and other things, and there is no compensation or help from that side of it, and so they have to steal money from operations to help muddle through that. And that's, and the, you know, we finally did make a small change in the formula, and there is some money, but again, it's taking operations money and giving it to the fast growth districts, but it doesn't address all their needs because of the capital, the cost of land, the cost of buildings, and it's just kind of like the declining issue. You can stuff kids in classrooms for a while, but eventually you've got to have a new building. And that's the, when you're stuffing them in there, in some respects, more kids per student, you stuff or per classroom, you build up some monies by doing that, but you don't ever get to address the cost of putting up the facilities to move those kids and keep them here.
I've forgotten, you're right. We had added later, we didn't do it at the time.
No, it was
the capital construction grant that is really designed to sort of fund the, like the furniture or the setup costs of a new building that the capital levy because of Measure 50 can't fund.
But the problem with that part is it isn't enough to fund all that's necessary. We put a cap and they prorate it because there's not enough there. And two, it's taking operating money out of everybody to fund what really are capital costs.
Capital needs, yeah.
All of those units that are temporary, and in certain areas they call them the villages because there are so many of those temporary units.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how you feel about it, but it sounds like we're into how the formula really works, and
right.
That's the next presentation. So it might be an excellent segue to the
Mark. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Jim will be back for the assessment section of the agenda to talk about the chalkboard findings on the formula and recommendation.
Chair Butler, Chair Flores, for the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. My dubious role this morning is to talk about how the formula works, the mechanics of it. You've had a very good discussion and covered some of the territory that I intended to include and can drop now. So I'll skip over quite a few slides because I don't think they're necessary anymore from the discussion that you've already had. But basically, we want to get an overview of the mathematics and mechanics of the formula. Let me see if I can get this started here. Let's see. For some reason, what I thought would show up isn't showing up.
You have that problem too.
I do.
Computer locked. Oh.
Control who we all are.
I'm glad to see that have somebody.
We have push control.
That's what you need. The right person with the
right
password.
You've got the same password as I do.
Mine's longer.
Oh, black dots.
I have more black dots.
Okay, here we go. Anyway. Now, most of you have seen this before, right? So it won't be new in that sense. Hopefully you'll learn something new about it, though, in the process. Maybe not, since we have to make up some time. So you'll have to kind of give me some guidance as to what I need to spend more time on, what I can basically skip over.
I think this is a very dedicated group. They want the whole load.
Well, but you don't want to miss lunch either. Anyway, school finance, sharing state and local resources, as you have discussed already this morning. I want to give you a little bit more information about how the money gets divided up in terms of what's available, how's it divided up. So I give three levels of equity in that process. One is how you divide up the money between all school districts and all ESDs. Okay? Once you have the all school district amount, then how do you divide it up among the school districts? And that's what we'll spend most of the time with for my presentation. And then there's also how does it get divided up among ESDs. Basically, I'm going to skip that. Okay, so we have an equalization formula. I just list here a number of things that the formula is not about. Okay. All of these adequacy, stability, quality, accountability, those weren't really topics back in 1991 when the formula was adopted. They came after. So you won't find these really addressed in the formula, even if they could be. What it is about is defining equity as discussed. And I like to think of it as measuring the relative need of the school districts given certain student and district characteristics. And that's where the weights come in. It doesn't tell you what the total amount of funding should be. It says what's the relative need of each school district, or what should their share of that total be. That's what the formula is trying to do. Again, it's legislative policy. It's changed and will continue to change over time. Now, this is my simple approach to the formula. This is mathematically as simple as I can make it. State revenue plus local revenue equals the sum of four grants: a general purpose grant, transportation grant, facility grant, facility grant. We've talked about those this morning already without the labels. Okay. But this just puts labels on them, and then what we want to do is fill in some of the detail for each of those labels. By the way, I deleted the slide that I have about the principles on which the formula is built. Jim said he thought I would cover it. I thought Jim would cover it. So, it's not here.
Madam Chair.
That's one of those.
There was only one I had a question. I think they're pretty, easy to understand, except the last one. Avoid incentives for school districts to increase their allocation. Minimize number of classifications and set limits. Can you comment on that, Mr. Murray?
Yes, Chair Flores, that goes back to the 11%. Right? That's a limit on the number of students that can be classified as special ed students. And there's some others, but that's the primary example of that. Just a quick state school fund, currently about $5.3 billion with a couple of additions that were made during the interim. This is higher than what the closure session number was. Most of it is general fund revenue, a little bit lottery. What's it used for? Not quite all of the money goes to school districts and education service districts. There's a little bit taken off the top for the small high schools and small districts. Some for state special education programs. This is for deaf and blind students, their education, for educating students in hospital programs or long-term care programs. And in this last session, $2 million was set aside for the Department of Education to develop the virtual school program. And so those both kind of come off the top. have first call on the state school fund. Then it's a matter what's left over gets combined with the local revenue for school districts and the local revenue for education service districts. Once that total is determined, 95.25 or 95.25% goes to school districts. Local dollars and state school fund dollars. The other 4.75% goes to ESDs. So that's that initial equity measure between all school districts and all ESDs. Formula revenue. Property taxes collected, whether it's for the current year taxes or the prior year, both are included. Initially, that was taxes imposed, but there was change to taxes collected because my memory isn't real clear on this, but there was a court case, and I think a taxpayer won a valuation case, and they had paid the taxes, so there was a big refund, and so it hurt that district that had to pay that refund. There's a small amount from the county school fund. The federal forest revenue is from the Secure World Schools Federal Act that may or may not continue. There's the state managed county trust forest, the Tillamook timber primarily. A little bit from ESD excess revenue. There's a few ESDs whose local revenue is more than what ESD allocation says they should have. When that ESD equalization process was fully implemented, it was realized at the time that there would be this situation, and so it was set up so that they would have to share that excess with their school districts, and then the school districts would have to report that as local revenue in the following year. And just a tiny bit of in lieu of property tax revenue. You can see from this that property taxes is by far the largest portion, about 91%. The other ones are relatively minor in comparison. Okay, so we've dealt with state revenue and local revenue. You might want to refer to this part of the equation formula as show me the money portion. Okay? The bottom part, you might say, this is the follow the money portion.
Representative Berger is recognized.
Steve, just to be clear before you move on, your first slide in 0507 biennium, $5.3 billion state school fund money.
Yes.
Local formula, 2.45.
Right.
So you add those to 8.75.
7.75.
Sorry about the math. And then you start. We're starting with that amount of money and allocated to the formula.
For a biennium.
For a biennium. Okay. So 7.75 is what you're distributing now, starting now.
Yes, but annually.
Not biennially.
Not biennially. The state school fund appropriation is divided up. The biennial amount is divided up into 2 years.
So basically each year it isn't equalized. I understand that. But for the biennium, it's 7.75.
Yes.
Okay. But the formula is allocated. Okay. I just want to be sure that the numbers were on the same page as to where are we starting for the biennium, which is 7.75.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to go to the follow the money portion and just touch on each of the grants just to fill in a little bit more information. Starting with the facility grant and working to the left. But one more step in this process. These are the cost factors that we currently have that deal with student characteristics, district characteristics, to distinguish one from another, saying, why does one need more money than the other? These are the only five that the department deals with. Student weights, teacher experience, transportation costs, high-cost disability students, and new facility costs. The new facility was added in the 99 session, the high cost disability in the 03 session. Only those factors. Now, you can argue that they should be different, or there should be more, or there should be less, but these are the ones that we currently have that distinguish district relative needs to the districts. Okay, facility grants. Up to 8% of construction costs. It's never been at 8%. Why? Because of the cap on the total amount that 8% can represent in a biennium. It's going to be $25 million. It was 17.5 per biennium, but the last session raised it to 25 beginning in 07-08. It's current, current biennium, it'll be somewhere between 3-4% because of the cap. The cap has never allowed it to go up to 8%. It can't be used for new construction, as was mentioned. It was for classroom equipment and portable equipment. And it's paid in the school year that the facility is first used.
Well, it's interesting to see that it's up to 8% of the construction cost, but it can't be used for construction.
Right. Again, it's to help compensate for the change in 97 in terms of what could be bonded in the construction process. And Measure 4750 said you can't use it for equipment.
Okay.
Whatever, you can only bond what's intrinsic to the structure or attached to the structure. And so this was passed to kind of compensate for that limitation on what could be bonded in the construction process. Okay, so it can be new construction, additions, portables, can it include land costs? Any questions about the facility grant costs or grant?
I think we answered the question. It does not include any information technology as well in facilities. I mean, I know it doesn't include furniture and fixtures. What about IT?
It doesn't tell you what you can spend it on. Okay. It just tells you that if you spent this much for construction, you're eligible for some dollars. The original intent was to help compensate for that equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no direct link.
There's a global, can you give us a little insight on that?
The 4750, when you go out for a bond issue, you can't buy the stuff that goes inside the school. Okay. So in IT, you can put all the wiring in. That's okay. Part of the construction cost. So it's there. Okay. The individual computers, no.
Or software.
Or software. And so this is to help with computers and software.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, the high cost disability grant equals up to the sum of the cost above $30,000 per disability student. Right, that was changed this last session from $25,000 threshold to $30,000. The idea was to keep the cap at $12 million per year and take out the marginal students, the ones that had high cost between $25,000 and $30,000. Delete those so that there's less paperwork and students to track as to whether they're high cost or not. And then also to try to increase that percent of the eligible cost that the grant would cover, that the grant would equal. So it took out basically about half of the students with the intent of reaching something higher than 70% of eligible costs. And hopefully it will get up to 85 or 90%. But I think the districts are getting better at recognizing what those eligible costs are.
Virginia Klump is recognized.
Thanks, Chair Butler and Flores. Steve, how does the funding work for students that are like at the Perry Center? Are they included in this? And that's students that have high emotional and behavioral issues?
I'm not familiar with the Perry Center.
Okay. Do you know?
Virginia Rowland?
Perry Center has two different parts. And the part that they took over the state hospital students, that's a separate fund. You pay that, it was in the list earlier, there's some special funds that are used to pay for state. The others, I would expect, might, if you because your local district is going to be affording the cost, and so if they well above the $30,000 cost, they would probably be listed as their students, would be my guess.
The question I have is, you know, if a student is, you know, it's we're possibly blending two pots of money from DHS, Department of Human Services, and special ed, and I just didn't know how that blended together.
I can print that one, I can. Because the Perry Center has an education unit that running at the campus in Portland would be Portland Public Schools. So they're paying, this is the education part, not the DHS part. So it would be separate money, but two different activities.
All right. So high cost disability grant, again, limited to $12 million a year. Transportation grant, you've had some discussion of this already. It equals 70 to 90% of approved transportation costs. In effect, this is a reimbursement grant. You have to spend the transportation dollars to qualify for the grant.
But yes, for renewal. Thank you. Now, there's no limit on this one from the state, so we have no limit to our possibility of incurring costs.
Chair Butler, if I wrote them correct, there's no cap or limit.
Okay, so this is done before and then readjust the deal after if it came out more? I mean, the basic formula? How does that work?
There's an estimate of what those costs will be initially for the initial payments, and once the actual dollars are known, it's rebalanced in the final payment.
And there is a provision for heroic changes in what was planned for. The deviation from planning to expenditure isn't really great from year to year.
That's true.
It isn't volatile up and down.
Steve, remind us again what the 70 to 90%. 90%, who gets the 90%?
Okay. In 90, trying to remember which session this started. 03, I guess. The department calculates the transportation cost per student for each district. And then the districts are ranked from high to low on the cost per student. If you're in that top 10%, you get 90% of your transportation, approved transportation costs eligible for the grant. If you're in the next 10%, you get 80%. And the bottom 70% of the bottom 80% of the districts then stayed at their 70% grant level.
Representative Donald,
could you explain why that is done that way? What's the rationale behind that?
The rationale is that if everybody got 70%, the question is who pays for the other 30%? Right? It has to come out of other district money. Okay? If the district is spending $500 per student for transportation, that 30% is a lot more than if the district is only spending $100 in transportation costs per student. And so the district that's spending $500 had to come up with more dollars per student for their 30%. And that was thought to be unfair, I guess, that they should get a higher percent.
Which schools, generally speaking, would fall in the 90% reimbursement rate?
Generally, the smaller, more rural schools are traveling a lot of miles per student.
Thank you.
Steve, if schools, let's just take the bottom percent that gets 70% reimbursement, if they get 70 cents for every dollar, transportation dollar spent back, is there an incentive for them to find efficiencies when they get three-fourths of their money back?
Well, that's a question for the districts to answer, really. Is 30 cents on the dollar enough? I don't know. For some it probably is, for others it may not be. If I get 30% off when I go to the store, that's an incentive for me.
Thank you, Chair Butler and Flores. Steve, and maybe other people understand this, but I don't quite. Now, like this year when the cost of petroleum went up so high, so if and this really doesn't have to do with the formula, I don't think, but so then when, you know, transportation costs increased, does that come out of a school's general fund then to pay that increased, you know, let's say they're not going to be able to hire an additional teacher because of the increased fuel costs? Because I don't understand.
Sure, but representative Trump, when the price of gas goes up, the transportation costs go up.
Right.
And 70% of that cost increases.
Okay.
And so the transportation grant is going to increase. The question is, where does that money come from?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I was going to get to that later.
Oh, I'm
but,
sorry.
Well, can we hold that? Or shall I answer it now?
I need a long time for the answer for that. So.
If I forget, remind me.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Here you just have what the approved costs are for. Mostly it's for home to school and school to home transportation. You have a chart that shows how transportation costs have improved over time and what the 70% and 30% amounts are of that total transportation costs.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Manager. Sir, does Portland get reimbursed for their metro passes, and do any school districts rent out their buses to make a profit, and how does that get distributed back to them, or how does that figure into the transportation grant?
Chief Representative Wilson, if a school district contracts out for bus service with a private supplier, that's eligible. The bus passes, I believe, are also eligible.
Whether the school district rents their buses out for senior citizens or something like that, is that possible or allowed? And is that to make money on it? Does that ever happen?
That would not be eligible for transportation costs because it has to be related to the students. If they might do that, they might get some money for it, but the mileage and the cost for doing that would not be included.
And it's my understanding, as looking at that list over transportation costs that are involved in field trips, right, those are included, but school athletics probably not.
No.
Okay. And then any of the income that would come off of bus rental would come in as other local revenue, not subject to the formula, not subject to accountability.
I would say yes.
Okay, all right. That was my question. That does happen then, I guess, so where schools are able to make some money for that.
Okay. Okay, next moving on to the last of the four grants, the general purpose grant. It's equal to weighted students, and you've had some discussion of weighted students, so we'll touch on that a little bit more. Those weighted students are multiplied against the $4,500 per student amount, adjusted by a teacher experience factor, and then balanced to available funds. And we'll deal with, again, each of these components separately, starting with weighted students. There's several different measures of weighted students, and I'm one that you can accuse of using the acronyms. But the two that are important here are the ADMR, with kindergarten weighted at one-half, which is normally referred to as just ADM. So ADM assumes that kindergarten is half-weighted. The other one is extended ADMW, which is just a weighted count, again, higher of last year or the current year number. And we say ADMW, and you'll see ADMW when we're actually using ADMW extended, because that's the formula measure. Okay? We don't say extended all the time. So it's just assumed, just so you're aware of that.
Where in the formula do we use the extended? Is that for the declining enrollment?
Yes. Declining enrollment, yes, I mean, in terms of if a district has declining enrollment, they're using the prior year AD.
That's the only place it's used.
Yes.
Thank you.
But again, you need to know what that ADMW number is for each year before you know which one you're going to use in the formula. Okay, the weights, we've talked about these. This just tells you the total weight by type of special education and at-risk category of students. Or if you want the added weight, just subtract one from each of those.
Riverview Comp is recognized.
Thanks, Chair Butler. Steve, back on that, and I apologize for being delinquent, that on that previous chart about the formula, is it not that one, the one in between, that one, that if a student in high school attends school for half the day, the district gets a full proportion of the funding? Oh, I see somebody saying no. That because I was wondering if there's an inconsistency between half-day kindergarten compared to a high school student that only attends a half-day.
I don't think I can answer that in terms of how much of the day they have to attend before they're considered there for a full day.
Brian Reeder's jumping at your heel there. He does want to answer now.
Pardon me for being an interloper, but I do know the answer to that question. Chair Flores, Representative Comp, the way the law currently reads is if a student attends a half day, they get, we call that, we measure FTE. So if they're a half FTE, they get funded as a half of a student. If they attend more than a half day, you know, even this much more than a half day, the law says we count them as a full FTE. So they get funded for a full day.
Follow up on that?
Please follow up.
So is there a numerical number attached to what is a half day? If a half day at a high school is 2 hours and 40 minutes, and yet a kindergartner is in school 3 hours in the morning, which many kindergartners are, I'm really curious about that equity on that funding.
Chair Flores, Representative Comp, we don't measure it in terms of time. Typically, we measure it in the high school example in terms of classes. So if the school is on an 8-period day and the student is there 4 periods, they're enrolled 4 periods, that's a half day. If they're enrolled 5 or more, that's a full day. If it's a 7-period day, 3 would be half, 4 would be full. 4 or more would be full.
And follow up by Representative.
And then that begs the question, Brian, what if they're on block scheduling?
Well, I mean,
you have some formula for accounting for that, I presume?
Yeah, I mean, it typically, even if they're on a block schedule, that equates to a 6 or 7 or 8-period day in some sense. Okay. And so, you know, the guidance we give to districts is, you know, what portion of a full day in terms of class periods are they there? And you don't measure it on a daily basis. You say, you know, in general, if they're enrolled for 3 courses, then they're going to be half day.
Okay. I don't want to belabor that too much.
I got to send that call. Thanks, Chair Flores. Just another little thing to help me understand, because the other, I think statutorily, school districts are supposed to provide 900 hours of instruction or something for a school year, but there's nothing that says middle school needs to be in students need to be in class 7.2 hours, or elementaries need to be in class for 7 hours. There's no definitive. Are there variations of the length of school days for students? That's my question. Because we say we have to be in school 190 days, but right. What does that mean in actual instructional time?
Chair Flores, Representative Comp, we put limits on the number of hours students can be in school each day. So we don't. Other than that, we don't set minimums, but we do set maximums. And I, off the top of my head, I don't know what those are.
Okay.
But
thank you.
You can't have kids in school 10 hours a day for only 3 days a week. You need to spread it out more and meet the yearly minimum.
Because you just answered my question that we have we don't have a minimum, but we do have a max.
Correct.
A maximum amount.
Correct.
Thank you.
All right, I do want to talk about two weights in particular. The IEP one extra weight. I'm currently in the final stages of finishing a research report on this weight that should be available in a couple of weeks. The IEP students are about 13.3% of EDM. Okay. I'm using the acronyms now. I hope you're honored. Remember what they stand for.
It stands for. Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the 11% of ADM without the waiver. And 25 districts are below that 11% still. And so they're not all above 11%, not quite. And 167 are above. The waiver process adds about 4,500 IEP weights. I say students, but clearly students that are eligible for the double weighting. So you have about 89% of the IP students that are double weighted. So it's with 11% with the waiver process, you're almost including all but not quite all of the IEP students are double weighted, 89%. The other issue that always comes up, well, are they spending more dollars than what the weight represents in terms of revenue dollars? Okay. And the data, assuming that I haven't made any fatal flaw yet, which hasn't been found in the report and in the methodology that I use in putting this together, about half of the districts report IEP costs less than the value of the dollars generated by the weight, by the extra weight. The other half are saying we're spending more than the weight dollars represent. Yes.
Are they using a consistent approach to what our costs in that process? Aids, books, medical, transportation, those kind of things, Steve?
Chair Butler, this is based upon accounting codes that the district are using and identifying for this year.
Can I go back to a high-level question with regard to these weights, Steve? We have 600,000 live bodies, more or less.
Yes.
How many total weighted students do we report statewide?
Let's see. I think I had that number written down here somewhere. There's about 70,000 IEP students.
Okay. Which is
on a later slide, I have some numbers.
So what percentage, I guess, is what I'm looking for, and not necessarily the numbers. If I've got 100% students ADM, then what is my ADMW in relation? Is it 120%, 150%?
Well, the ADMW is typically about 100, on average, 124% above ADM.
Okay, all right. So, and thank you very much for that information. So, my ADMW, if I've got 600,000 students, and I take it times 124%, find out what weighted amounts are being spread around the state amongst the 198 school districts. Now, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if I were to look at those school districts, do I find a larger proportion in some school districts than in others as to the 24%?
Yes.
And do we know where those are? Are those mostly rural? Are those mostly metropolitan districts? Do we have any? Is it random? Is it truly random?
Whether it's above or below the 20 additional 25%,
exactly.
I would say it would be pretty much every district is going to have weights above their ADM. So
certainly,
it's all going to be higher, but whether they're above or below the 20-foot, the average by type of district, I'm not sure.
Difficult to tell. Okay. Final question in that regard, and that is this. These folks tend to move around a lot. Our superintendents tend to move around some every few years. Principals,
yes,
kinds of things. Do they tend to take a school that's got 115% with them and move 115% over to another? And conversely, if they're 125, or let's say it's 130% ADMW in their particular situation, do they go into a school district that's 115 and bring it back up to 130? You know, ever followed that?
Sure,
but you're implying there's manipulation available.
I'm just better accounting, that's all. That you've never tracked that.
No.
We'll have COSA come up and tell us about that later on.
Representative Gollum had a question.
Steve, you talked about allocating special ed money, and Ozzy and Steve told us that we picked the weight of two, and it sounded like that weight of two is still holding. You did some research on a number of special ed students, amount of dollars spent, and it came out there was less money spent on special ed than the weighting formula was allocating?
For about half the districts.
And it was
now, what was interesting about that, though, is that for the districts where the revenue was a little bit more than what they were reporting as costs, it was only a little bit more. Right? For all of those, it was only about $10 million more. If you look at the other districts, though, that were spending more than the weight revenue, they were spending tremendously a higher amount. Right? So that their shortfall was about $90 million. Well, no, actually, it was over $100 million for those districts. And then the other $10 million for those where the revenue was a little bit more than their cost, the net was about $90 million shortfall.
Do you have, thank you, Madam Chair, do you have any comments for why this is, what causes this to happen?
Chair Flores, Representative Allen, I think you would have to relate it back to the kind of disability students the district has predominantly. Are they low-cost disability students? Are they high-cost disability students, and in what proportions?
If I jump to the conclusion that some districts were offering more or better services, that wouldn't be appropriate. Some districts are tagged with a disproportionate number of high-cost students, would be the answer.
I think that would probably dominate the differences in program costs.
Thank you.
Steve, nothing in your research, or should I say, should I ask, did you in your research determine whether students who have been categorized as requiring an individualized education plan, if in fact they require that particular category, or anecdotally we hear that some of those would be better served in 501 plans, which are less?
Chair Flores, no. I didn't get into that at all.
4, 3, 2. You did not go into that, so you didn't necessarily explore whether they were accurately classified then.
No. Okay. I had no way of doing that.
Thank you.
Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along that, kind of that same line, what you're indicating is that districts in general are spending more than the money that's allocated by the formula for special needs students in excess statewide,
yes.
$90 million worth. So it doesn't appear that they're using special ed students to fund other programs. It looks like they're using other programs to fund special ed programs as a state.
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, yes.
In 50% of the cases.
On average, yes.
On average. About $90 million more statewide.
Before we go there, I think we have to go back to the this is a distribution formula not a spending formula. So I pursue that line of questioning myself, but we have to go back to the genesis of the formula. It's to get the money out there. It's not to tell the district how to spend it.
Mr. Flores, that's correct. But the question keeps coming up. And so I thought, if it came to a point where the legislature got serious about changing the extra one weight, they would want that kind of information. And so I was basically trying to be prepared for that possibility. I probably should have been spending my time on transportation. Okay, I also have a report out on the English as a second language, extra one half weight, that's available out on the website. 124 districts reported ESL students. They're about 11% of average daily membership. They reported costs of about $1,500 per student. The extra half weight generates about $2,600 in revenue. Doesn't have to be spent in any particular way. It's just revenue from the weight for ESD students. Ignoring federal funds. By the way, the prior report and also the report on the IEPs included federal dollars in that process. Here, it didn't. Federal funds for ESL are very minimal. And only 12 districts reported costs more than the dollars generated by the weight. And so that matches up with the anecdotal evidence, I think, that you've probably heard. That was based on 03-04 data. The other report is based on 04-05 data. And so it's just kind of the reverse picture for ESL from IEPs. Okay, here we just have, you can get an idea of the relative number of students for each of the weights. Don't want to spend any time on that. You can look at dollars associated with the weight compared to the one weight. Special education, the double weight, so the column is twice as high, and so on, for the general purpose grant. I'm going to skip through some of this. We've talked about kindergarten, elementary, union high. We talked about the small schools and how much that weight is. This is just a chart that gives you a picture of the added weight based upon the school, high school size, if they have four grades, and it phases out at 350 students. Qualifications to be a small high school, there has to be in a district under 8,500. You can be a small school in a large district, right? For the small school correction group, but being a small high school, you have to be, the district has to be under 8,500 ADMW. You can't take a current school and split it in half to try and qualify under this. It relates back to if you had been a small school, you can still be a small school. You can't be a new small school. Okay. Elementary qualifications, 224 students for 8 grades. If you're smaller than that, again, you had to be small back in 1995. And you have to be a certain distance from the nearest elementary school. This is just gives you an idea of going back to the comparison between ADM, ADMW extended. How do they compare? Here's where you see that 24% extra. Okay, the other factor in the general purpose grant is the teacher experience adjustment. Districts get that $4,500 increased. If their teacher experience is above the state average, they get it reduced if their teacher experience is below the state average. Okay. And it's $25 per year. So they're either adding to the $2,500 or subtracting from it. Statewide, those additions and subtractions about balance out to zero. So some districts are gaining, some districts are losing by that adjustment process.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you. Excuse me. Okay, so going back to the general purpose grant, the only item left over is the balance ratio. Okay. And you talked a little bit about this being about an additional 16%. So you have the $4,500, it goes up or down $25 per year, difference in teacher experience. You multiply that number times the rated students. If you add the four grants together, do they add up to the state and local revenue dollar total or not? The balance ratio here says keep increasing the general purpose grant until the sum of the four grants match the state and local dollars available. That's how the balancing process works. What does that balance number have to be to make the four grants equal available dollars? Okay? So that's about as straightforward as I can make it. What this formula does then is to just take the initial simple labels and put a little bit more detail with it, so that in the lower box, in the upper left hand corner, you have the general purpose grant, the 70% to 90%, that's the transportation grant, etc. And hopefully if you have this level of detail, you're understanding the formula, I think, very well. If you follow through that and keep this in mind. This just gives you the relative importance of the four grants, general purpose, over 95% of the total. That's why the weights are so important. That's where most of the money is, in terms of how it gets split up. And this is 1 year, about $3.6 billion represented here. Payment schedule, double payment in July, 1/12 for the next 10 months, no payment in June. Now, what I wanted to just spend a few minutes on yet is to talk about some what-if examples of how the formula works. So I know the components now. How do you put it into practice? Right? Can you tell what's going to happen with the various proposals or changes that might be in legislation? Let's take, for example, the facility grant. If there's an unusual increase in the number of districts that have new classrooms that they've opened, and they're applying for the facility grant, what happens? Does that affect all of the school districts in the state because one or two or three have this huge increase in facility costs that they're applying for? The answer is no, only because there's a cap on that grant. There's more costs available, they're eligible, but the cap hasn't changed. What it's doing is thinning the soup in terms of how that cap, those cap dollars are divided up among the districts eligible for the facility grant.
Does the, in each biennium, is all of the money up to the cap used?
Yes. That's why you never get to the 8%. Okay, high cost disabilities grant. What if there's a change in the law or a federal mandate for additional services to high-cost disability students that greatly increases their costs? What happens? Are all districts affected in that process, or just a few? Again, the answer is the same. There's a cap.
That's right.
Okay. So there's more eligible costs. But again, it just has to be thinned out and spread out over those additional costs. So it's not affecting other districts that do not have high-cost disability students. It's affecting the distribution among the high-cost disability districts. Transportation grant. Gas taxes. Cost of gas has gone up. Transportation costs have increased. The grant goes up. So it's more than it was. What happens? Assuming that state revenue and local revenue hasn't changed, where does the money come from? Right? We have to rebalance the formula. It has to come from the general purpose grant because the balance ratio now is going to drop a little bit. So it's a trade-off between the general purpose grant and the transportation grant. It's not more dollars. It's not. It doesn't automatically generate more dollars available to the system. What about the general purpose grant? If there's a change in the statute that adds a new weight, or changes one, it increases one of the existing weights, what happens? Again, doesn't say that there's more money available. State dollars and local dollars haven't changed. The transportation grant hasn't changed. The high-cost disability grant hasn't changed. The facility grant hasn't changed. It just redistributes the money within the general purpose grant. If there's more weights, there's fewer dollars per weighted student. What happens if local revenue increases for some unexpected reason? Suppose the feds come through and say, we're going to double your timber dollars in the distance.
Okay. Is there any reason for us to...
Wrong choice for the example. Right, local revenue has increased. What changes under the equal sign? We haven't changed transportation costs. We haven't changed the caps for the high-cost disability grant or the facility grant. There's more money available for the general purpose grant. So that there's going to be more dollars per weighted student available to keep it in balance. Is that enough?
And so what we're saying in the last one is that it redistributes that money that those districts were getting to everybody else, including themselves. So
including themselves. For those districts that have the additional revenue,
right,
their local revenue has increased. The formula amount has stayed about the same, so if their state dollars goes down for those three districts, those state dollars are then available for all of the other districts. The utilization process.
Any questions?
Okay. Yeah, you understand the formula. When you get a bill to change it, you can have some idea of what might be going on, what's the consequence of that change. Okay, yeah. Just a couple other things here. Shows you how dollars have changed over time. I don't want to really spend any time on that. And again, on a per student basis, you see a few years where it's up and down, but mostly up. This is a slide that I like to show that I think dramatically illustrates the equalization consequences or results from the 15 years phase in and using the formula. If you go back to 91-92, the revenue per weighted student shows a variation of $3,000 to close to $6,000. And this is only students, only districts that had more than 580. If you included those smaller districts, it would be even more dramatic in terms of the difference between the high and low funded districts per student. Compare that to the almost horizontal but jagged line for 0304 revenue per weighted student. Instead of the differences being measured in thousands of dollars per weighted student, it's now measured in hundreds of dollars difference per weighted student. That's what the equalization formula has accomplished.
Mr. Chair,
Madam Chair.
I just like the committee to note, Steve, you go back your last two slides, please. I guess the next one, and then my point is, we talked ADM and we talked ADMW, and then now we're going back, and the next slide you had up is ADM. This one here.
This one is ADMW.
Well, let's get it. You stop when they're talking ADM. You go back. We go back and forth. Yes. Is my point. When we get to the discussion part about changes, this is where I want the people. One of the main things that came out of Chalkboard, the Business Association, be transparent. Let's be sure the people understand what we're talking about when we're funding. When we're funding a student, or are we funding a weighted student? And I think that's important for the public to realize that. And I think we can change that easily. I'll defer to the ODE experts, but I think it can be changed. Thank you. Cheers.
Chair Flores, wasn't it? It does cause confusion, right? Because when you see a graph or some numbers, in the heading you'll probably see per student, but you don't know what the measure of the students that was used for that. So some numbers look large, some numbers look small on a per student basis, probably because one's on ADM, one's on ADMW.
Madam Chair,
I
just would like to make certain, though, that I understand where Representative Wiener is coming from. Are there any? There are federal formulas that work out the weighting. Are there any states that don't use weighting of the mentorship students that you're aware of?
Chair Butler, I believe there are some that do not use weighting.
That do not use weighting.
Correct.
But federal formulas have weighting that come with them. Do they not? For ESL?
Some of the federal dollars are on a census basis, number of students, regardless of whether they are disability students or not.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll explain when we get to that
point. Okay, I'm
not saying do away with them. I want to have another category.
Okay, all right.
There's a few minutes.
Right here.
Left, I guess, to talk about history, but you've had most of that already. I guess what I would like to talk about the phase-in process and the floors and the ceilings, to skip over that, about the guarantees. In 95, you added youth correction education program students at a double weight. So you basically treated those students as though they are in their own school district and made them eligible for formula dollars. 97, even though there had been some guarantees in terms of revenue being the same as last year, it was in 97 that this was really put into the statutes. Where you got the higher of three calculations. You were given, a district was given the prior year revenue as a stop loss grant, or the prior year revenue per student times the current number of students for a flat grant per student. So you had a stop loss grant district, you had flat grant districts, and then you had formula districts where the highest amount was determined by the equalization formula without constraints. And that, so that continued then until 01, when the constraints were not renewed. Let's see. This was also the time when the high revenue districts were brought down to $4,800 by one-third increments per year. It was finally realized that you were never going to equal up to the high revenue districts, and so because of revenue constraints, and so it was finally decided how to bring those down to meet the districts that you're also bringing up in revenue. and it added the facility grant. In 99, you increased the legislature increased the facility grant to 8% or $17.5 million. It started freezing out the distance adjustment for the small high schools, added a local option, and started the ESD equalization process. While the phase-in for school districts was going on, ESDs were basically ignored for trying to equalize their dollars. So in 99, the legislature started doing that. 01, formula fully implemented, added another weight category for juvenile correction education program students at a half weight, started equalizing the local option, and phased in ESD equalization, share of state and local dollars. So again, it was also a phase-in process for how much do all school districts get out of the available formula and local dollars, and how much do ESDs get. 03 was the transportation change and the adding the high cost disability grant and raise in the local option limits. 05 changed the high cost disability grant to the $30,000 that we talked about, increased the facility grant cap to $25 million per biennium, again starting in 07-09. Didn't change the ESD phase in process. And did adjust the local revenue reduction in the special session to add 3 years to the exception for Portland for their local revenue. So we're back to about where we started, and that is the end.
Questions at this point? Thank you very much. I'm sure questions will come up as we continue our discussions. However, Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our 10:30 time has passed by about 45 minutes. However, we just add Brian Reeder to the dais, and Steve, you just move over and let Brian join you. Is that what happens?
Wow.
Probably just take a 3 minute stand up break, not a leave the room break, and we'll go off the record for just 3 minutes, please, Robin.
We'll reconvene and move forward with our agenda, which, as Representative Butler noted, that we are at the 10:30 portion and we're going to be talking about modifications to the formula over time. And
Madam Chair, we're actually to the current assessment, so we are
on time. How did that happen? We covered it all.
He told us he was going to do that.
He did double duty.
Well, you get double points.
And Brian,
that's true.
Double weighted. Yeah, there we go.
Let's see. It looks like we're looking for Jim Scherzinger, and then Ken is here. Ken Hunsaker from COSA, Laurie Wilmer Whalen, and David Williams from SBA.
And I'm pretty sure that Mr. Scherzinger thought there was no way in this side of your area that we were going to be on time.
Mr. Chair, can I join this panel?
If you'd like to, yeah, you're good. Go ahead, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Who's going to take lead off for us?
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kent Hunsaker. I live here in Salem on 770 Hazeltine Avenue, and I'm currently the Executive Director for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Previously a superintendent for 25 years and actually teach a school finance class, so I'm a student of the state school fund formula. I don't view myself as an expert, but I'm a well-studied person on the formula. And don't wish to go to the same kinds of things, but it struck me as we were having the previous conversations that the formula was put into effect in 1991. There have been 7 legislative sessions since that session. And if you look at the formula, there have been very few changes in the formula as a whole. Some cosmetic things, transportation going from 70, 80, 90, high cost disability, very cosmetic changes. So when you think about that, one of two things comes to mind for me. Either this is a fantastic formula that everybody loves, or that it's very difficult to change. Okay? And I'd like to think there's a little bit of both in that. Since I'm a student of the formula, I think that it has done a pretty good job of addressing the various kinds of needs that school districts have across the state. I work with a group of superintendents that are known as the Funding Coalition. They review that formula on a every other year basis. There's kind of general agreement that the formula works pretty well. But if you were to talk with small district superintendents, they would advocate for changes that would benefit them. If you were to talk with growing district superintendents, they would probably advocate for changes that would benefit them. If you were to talk with declining enrollment district superintendents, they would like to see some changes that would benefit them. And maybe that's another good point for the formula when you think about it, is that people are not happy, but they are happy. They're thinking that overall it is pretty fair. And again, I would go back to, why haven't there been really significant changes? Well, the things that keep coming up, I'll take an example, declining enrollment districts, phantom students, right? Why hasn't there been some change in that if there's people that don't like it? Two-thirds of the districts are declining enrollment districts. If you're representing those districts, it's difficult to say, I'm going to be for something that's going to affect my districts in a negative way. And in fact, when you look at the formula, any change creates winners and losers in this system. And so whenever that's the case, then you're more likely to stay with the present system because you can't find a combination of things that really works. But think about the things that have worked. High-cost disability is a really great example. It is an uncontrollable cost that everybody agrees would be a good addition to the formula because it takes a group of students that are very difficult to fund and says we're going to provide money for that. So it's the kind of thing that you can get agreement on. But whenever we do runs with our superintendents that show what a proposed change would do, instantly you get people in camps. I imagine that happens in your system as well as it does in ours, that people will look at it and go, that's not good. I wanted to emphasize a couple of things. The principles that the formula is based on. Number one, that there be sharing of school funding sources statewide, district and local revenue. Many of you are aware that a district like Seaside doesn't receive any state funding. All their funding comes locally. That a district like Crestwell, where I used to be a superintendent, it has very low assessed value, gets quite a bit of money that's redistributed. We know the effect of Portland in this state in that a lot of Portland's local revenue goes to other parts of the state because they're a very wealthy district. Another important principle of the formula that it allows each district to decide how to spend its allocation. A key piece that's been out there, that whole local control that's been talked about. Another principle of the formula is that you only adjust funding to help with uncontrollable cost differences, and we have lots of examples of those. I mentioned the high-cost disability fund. Teacher experience is another one that fits into that category. More experience, higher cost salaries for teachers, it makes sense to have something in the formula that would do that. Transportation, one of those. And in fact, when we looked at the transportation formula and it was changed from 70, 80, 90, it was that some Eastern Oregon school districts were spending $2,000 a kid. Okay? And if there's a difference between $300 a kid and $2,000 a kid and you're getting 70%, it's a huge amount of money. And that was a way to treat those districts more fairly. uncontrollable cost differences. Facility grants. Again, fast-growing districts, the difficulty that's out there. Keep in mind that the facility grants, which were $17.5 million, have been raised to $25 million. I think that was in the presentation. Think about the bond measures that are out in this November election. Right? I've heard $1 billion, $250 million worth of bond measures out. Think how far, if most of those pass, how far this facilities grant fund will go in terms of providing money to them. Currently, they're getting 3% of construction costs for instructional facilities. I believe that with the high number of bond measures that are out there and many likely to pass, that will even go lower. So your facilities grant that has a cap on it, and a lot of bond measures is likely to provide very little funding for those districts, and is always a problem when you cap something. Wanted to mention a couple of things that are out there. Chalkboard has a proposal to redo transportation. Right. And you've seen that, it's been talked about many times. The question is, does the current transportation formula provide an incentive for people to spend more money? And would a change in that actually result in savings of some kind that could go towards schools? We've advocated that the formula works pretty well. We think that it does. I was a district superintendent, though, and I can recall a meeting where we were trying to decide whether to add another bus to our fleet and another route. But a part of that consideration was that we only had to pay 30% of the cost of adding that route because the state was going to pick up the other 70. I have to say it made it easier for us to say that was a good solution. But on the other side of that, is our districts, you know, spending way too much money on transportation? Probably not. You're not going to see significant changes in the things that occur out there by changing your transportation formula. And in fact, one of the concerns I have about changing that would be that, let's just say, because the proposal is provide a grant for transportation and cost of living increase and so on for future years. They're now stable. Then districts could go out and say, I'm going to save money here and I get to use it on my kids. Also, however, in the chalkboard piece is that we go back and we actually look at a way to allocate transportation dollars based on the real costs of providing transportation, cost per mile, that type of thing. It could well be that down the road there could be something else like that would actually take money away from these people, and that's where I think could be created by doing that. Local option. One of the things, it's not really a part of the formula, but when you look at local option, what does it take away from? It takes away from the equity that we have in our state between our districts, but it also provides opportunities for local people to get involved. Our superintendents support that, but it does take away from the equity that is achieved out there. I wanted to mention one thing, and I'll end with that and let my colleagues go on from here. This is that each session I hear a lot of conversation around the funding formula, and it's like if we do something here, we can fix this funding system. I believe the distribution formula is simply that. It's a distribution formula. It's not a measure of adequacy, and it's not a measure of stability. To me, the key issues in this state are those two issues. What's adequate funding for schools, and what's stability? Not the way the money is distributed, but those are the key issues this legislature will have to deal with. And how do we provide stability for not only education, but all of government? And what is adequate funding for schools? So you're not going to find that in the distribution formula. That won't correct those. No matter what you do, it doesn't deal with adequacy and stability. Thank you.
Thank you. It's like noon. When are we?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, representing 45,000 K-12 and community college employees in Oregon. I hope I won't sound like an echo chamber. A lot of what you've heard today are points of view that the Oregon Education Association shares with respect to the distribution formula, and I want to thank you for having this hearing. I think it's a valuable exercise to contemplate where we are with it, what might we see in terms of improvements, what's working well, and I hope that's the spirit in which this is going to be taken. The distribution formula is, I believe, often misunderstood by the public, by policymakers, even by educators. Some think it's a line item spending directive. Others think it rewards certain segments of the education community over other segments. Still others think somehow it creates money beyond the appropriated state school fund. And I think you have in your packet a letter that makes that case, that all districts under this new idea will get more money. Still the same size pie. Oregon's distribution formula is none of those things. It's simply a formula to calculate, as you've heard, how best to divide the pot you've already agreed to send to 198 school districts and the SDs based on what the Ways and Means Committee decides is the appropriation level for any given biennium. Most of the factors in the formula are intended to either equalize funding or to account for those uncontrollable cost variables among districts. It's not to reward or incent any particular kind of behavior. Teacher experience formula does not give some teachers more money. That's not what this formula does, and I've heard that expressed, so I wanted to make sure to call that out. We've traditionally regarded at OEA with great caution the policy proposals that come forward to tweak the formula. If it is addressing a true new need or an unaddressed need, or if we need to alter the numbers, that's one thing. We've supported many of those that you've heard about from others earlier today over the years. What we've not supported are those things that appear to cut one slice of pie bigger for one set of legislative districts than for others. And I call that Oregon's version of pork barreling. You know, they have pork barreling in Congress. This is Oregon's version of pork barreling when some people say, well, we can't grow the pie bigger because we don't only have a finite set of resources, therefore we're just going to take more for ours over here. That kind of thing, when those come forward, we do oppose them because we don't think that that benefits all children throughout the state. We've witnessed the tendency to regard the enterprise of the formula itself with some suspicion, and it's a mistrust that the Oregon Education Association does not share. We do trust the districts to employ their local control, the limited amount of it that they still have, with responsibility and fiscal wisdom. And we also oppose moving toward a system in which the legislature would appropriate funds in a categorical way, that is, to micromanage. All of this is not to suggest, however, that there aren't improvements that could be made that would be beneficial to the students of Oregon. Periodically, we think a responsible review makes some sense, and we know that there are unaddressed problems, whether it is adequate funding for facilities in high-growth districts or helping school districts with a precipitous drop in enrollment cope with that without hurting the programs they offer the students who remain behind. Those are some of the issues that we continue to grapple with. But at root, I would suggest that if we use or look to the distribution formula as the solution to a more fundamental problem, we are being distracted from the real goal, which is to make sure that there is an adequate number of dollars on the table to do the job that you all want school districts to do with the students of Oregon and to achieve those high standards that we all hope for. If the resources simply aren't there to do it, fighting over the crumbs isn't going to fix the problem. With respect to the transportation proposal that was mentioned just a moment again, I'm going to push back a little bit on the fundamental assumption underlying the whole idea of changing that. While we would agree that what you create systemically is going to induce, incent, or provide a disincentive to certain kinds of behavior, if that's true in a vacuum, we don't think this falls in line with that theory. It's true that MEM money is reimbursed, but it's also true that there are finite dollars, there are achievement expectations, and there are other kinds of controls on the system that ensure that districts are responsibly deploying all the money they have for all the line items in the budget. And I think it might be, however, unintentional and insulting to say that after $1 billion of cuts, in, either through direct cuts or accounting gimmicks over the last 5 years that schools have weathered, that they had the luxury to cavalierly waste money on this tiny little piece of the pie. I would like to see evidence of where that has occurred before we change the formula. Rather, to fix structurally those things that would lead to best practices in all school districts, we embrace the notions that are coming out of the accountability subgroup of the Senate Educational Excellence Commission with respect to showcasing best practices and sharing them. If some district has figured out an innovation in bus routes, let's share those with other districts. That makes some sense and copes with the issues of efficiency and maximizing resources in a way that I think is better than simply blindly going to another kind of formula for transportation. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions from
Madam Chair, I'm just waiting with bated breath to hear Representative Wisnant's additional weighting formula here.
I don't know that we're at that point for him.
Speakers.
Thank you, Chair Flores, Chair Butler, members of the committees. David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. I bring regrets from Jim Green, who was initially called to testify and has been called away this week on a family emergency. So with that, I don't really have much to add because I could not find any prepared remarks that he had prepared, since I don't know his password to his computer. But I will echo sort of the two main points that you've seen run through the testimony by my colleagues here, and that is this notion of funding versus spending, and that an inherent principle in the formula when it was originally created was this was a way for the state to determine in a rational, logical way how to distribute dollars down to the district level while still allowing and having faith in our locally elected public officials to best determine how those dollars are programmatically spent within the district. And then the other, of course, is the equity versus adequacy argument, and that, again, when the formula was established, and I think you heard this from just about all the speakers today, that it was established as a way to distribute that money equally on a statewide basis as the best the state defined as equity. It in no way was intended to define adequacy. You know, there have been numerous measurements beyond that, the quality ed model. There was a discussion earlier about the bifurcated process with the 21st Century Schools Reform and the initial reform movement and this formula movement. I think that they're not sort of intended to be coupled together, because the reform-based movement based on student outcomes is an effort by the state to establish its goals and then to define how much it would cost overall for the state to fund that. It's sort of almost irrelevant down to the level of how that money is distributed on a district-by-district basis. It's more relevant the discussion about how much will it actually take for the system as a whole to reach those intended goals. So with that, I'm just here to answer any questions that might come up from our perspective, and again, thank you for holding the hearing.
Seeing no questions, thank you very much. And Mr. Schrodinger, coming up.
Madam Chair, we didn't get Lori's handout. She said she provided.
So do I confirm the letter?
Oh, I think she's making reference to the letter that is at our mouth.
I'm Jim Scherzinger, and at this portion of the meeting, I guess I'm representing Chalkboard. Sue Hildick asked me to come down and describe for you the work that Chalkboard did in the equity area, and I have a one-page handout of what we did. And Brian Reeder is with me. He was one of the members of the team that worked on worked with the Funding and Accountability Work Group. We had a number of people, experts in the area of school funding, as well as some private business people that worked on these recommendations. So I'm just going to cover this one page. I guess a couple prefatory remarks. Number one, these were the recommendations of the Chalkboard Funding and Accountability Work Group. And that was a group that Chalkboard pulled together to make recommendations to their board, to the Chalkboard board. They have taken these recommendations and now have carried portions of the recommendations that we made into their proposals. And the only one really out of these that they have taken forward, it's not that they necessarily disagree with these. I think to some extent they thought these were boring or too technical or something, but or at least too much to explain. So the one they've really taken forward is the recommendation on the transportation factor. And they have not chosen to come in and make the rest of them part of their program. But she did want me to describe for you the work that we did on the Funding and Accountability Work Group. The other sort of prefatory part is that what they asked us to do, the team to do, was to make recommendations to their board on what a school funding system would look like under an outcomes-based system. So that was the assumption we started with. And we made recommendations not just on equity, but on adequacy, on efficiency, and you heard some of those actually in the prior conversation talked about, on transparency and on, what was the other one? I can't remember. There were five areas. And we made recommendations on all those things. And if I were to describe those, I'd be glad to answer any questions on them. We'd be here not only through lunch, but through dinner in that conversation. But I'm going to limit what I'm talking about to our recommendations on equity. And they're basically described in this single page. And then finally, when you talk about an outcomes-based school funding system, you have to, I think, recognize two things. Number one, in order to do that, because funding is an input, I mean, it's something that you put into the system and you want to get some result out the other side, is that you have to have some clarity of what outcomes you want in order to even talk about it. And to some extent, we've done a lot to specify minimum outcomes for our system. But we maybe have not said as much about how much we want output to vary by capacity. So, for example, if we have a school funding formula that talks about, well, how much do we allocate to special ed? I mean, how much adjustment are we going to make for special ed costs? You might want to have some sense of, well, how much output do you want there relative to a regular student, or same thing for ESL students or for any other factor that you're adjusting for, is you might want to have some discussion about what your expectations are. I know when I was at Portland Public Schools, the mission of the district is to really maximize the I guess you might call it output, it's the performance of every student, and challenge every student no matter what their capacity, and every student has a different capacity, and that's a different submission than it is to everybody achieving a certain minimum standard. And the second thing that you need to have some understanding of is the link between the inputs and the outputs. What are the best practices that you're trying to fund? And how much do they cost? And what kind of output can you expect from those practices? And that the committee, when we worked on this, we accepted that this is an area where there's a lot of experimentation in right now, that we're learning a lot about what's best practices, and that therefore any system that we would recommend has to be flexible enough to incorporate the learning of what's working and what's not working in our system. That we're not in a situation where it's pretty static and we pretty much know how to do this, and therefore we can fund it and expect these things to be steady over time. So that's sort of the attitude we went into when we did this.
I have a question, Madam Chair, if I may. Jim, relative to and reading your presentation, you specifically recommend the restructuring of the transportation factor. Is that back to the 70% to 90%? And what was the specific recommendation?
The recommendation that we made was, and actually we almost covered this as much in the efficiency section as we did in the equity section, although I think it fits in both, is that we move immediately to sort of a block grant based on what you got before, which at least gets you to the point where if you can save money, you can save it and reallocate that to your instructional program. It creates an incentive. But that you relatively quickly at least move to a system that funds based on per mile costs rather than. So in other words, it would set a standard for how much it ought to cost per mile to run a bus. And whatever that is, $100 a mile, $500, I don't know what the number would be. And that, therefore, if you could at least reduce your per mile costs, you would be able to take that money and reallocate it to education. Or if you were high on your per mile costs, that you would have some incentive to get them down to the average. That then you would look in the longer term at doing a more complex formula that tries to independently through, we did look at what, I forget, I think it was North Carolina that had done that other, it was North Carolina, that's what it was. We actually looked to see if that could be duplicated, and what we found out was that the company that did that really didn't do it anymore, and even that sort of expertise was lost, and it was relatively expensive to do at the time they did it. But that we felt like, you know, maybe the data was there to ultimately look at a better system, but we didn't really see it right now as being able to do that.
I guess
that was the specific recommendation that we made.
And Jim, whenever people as smart as the group that got together for Chalkboard, whenever folks with that kind of built-in intelligence come back and say, well, let's consider doing it this way, and then if you can become more efficient, if you can save money, if you can lower the costs, that indicates to me that maybe there's some fluff in there that you folks are recognizing, that maybe we'd ought to have a little bit more opportunity to discuss that in an education format, because it sounds like to me that you got some ideas that maybe we're spending more than we probably should be in some of the transportation.
We're moving in sort of the efficiency section, but one of the things the committee did was to look at what our costs were relative to other states and relative to national averages. And in the specific area of transportation, our actual per-student costs are about where they are on average to the rest of the country, but they're higher than they are in Washington and California. And so we thought that we ought to try to set a goal that was closer to what Washington was spending and try to create an incentive structure to get there.
Did you look at the rural nature of portions of Oregon versus the rural nature of California, perhaps?
And, you know, we didn't. I would say that we didn't have a whole. Remember, we were doing adequacy, equity.
Right.
I mean, we didn't really have the time or the resources to go really deeply into restructuring an entire formula.
Yes.
That's a huge effort.
Yeah, the concern that I always have looking to when we start talking about transportation is that really in Oregon, one size fits one. You've got an Eastern Oregon, you've got a Western Oregon, you've got a rural Oregon, you've got a metropolitan Oregon. I always get really concerned when really intelligent people gather together and say, we think we can save a lot of money on these kinds of transportation issues, when I've got folks that have just opted to go to boarding schools as opposed to trying to get the kids into school on a daily basis.
Representative
Jim, when you got your group together, and you were talking about outcomes, our uncoupled, far-flung enterprise allows the state government to set some outcomes in order to improve the dropout rate. We then set a distribution formula. Did you talk about any way that we might target parts of that formula so that we knew that dropout rates would be addressed? And one of the issues that is compelling and urgent to the legislature, although not... Did you talk about that, how we might, as an industry would, remedy or heal the areas that we want healed.
We did not talk about it in terms of an incentive structure in the sense of creating a positive incentive to achieve a particular goal. In other words, I think you end up in a conundrum when you go there. If you say that, well, if you get better outcomes, we'll give you more money, and at the same time you're saying that, geez, we really need to help the districts out that are struggling, that you end up in a conundrum. And so where we ended up is and I'll talk about it, and I probably should have it in the right context to talk about it, but down when we get down into re-estimating the weights and how you re-estimate them and the feedback loops that you get there is, I think, where we try to address that issue. How you deal with that conundrum of you want to reward success, but at the same time you have to be willing to make investments in areas where you're not succeeding, and how you deal with that. And I think I get to that when I get down below. So remind me if I forget when I get there.
Representative Abakian has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to a couple comments you made with regard to the process that the group went through in coming to its conclusions, and make some degree of sense to compare us to national standards or to what other states are doing, because you can objectify that. It makes it easier to make the comparison, but frankly, I see very little going on in any of the other states that makes me trust that their education system is working at some type of an optimum level that we should be shooting for. And in fact, when you look throughout Oregon's history, I think that we have done a much better job of providing services to students than many other states. So what I'm wondering, what would be more helpful to me is, instead of comparing us to other struggling systems, to know if you've done any kind of a qualitative analysis on the services that Oregon is providing to its students, rather than just some kind of a quantitative analysis based on the number crunching.
What, and Brian may want to say something about this, because I think he did some of that. What I would say is that what our group did when we looked at the standards of cost was you really looked in two areas. One was on business efficiencies, which, in other words, what do other states spend relative to us on services that are not directly educational services? And when it came to something like, something that's more directly educational, that you know, is there a better, more efficient way to provide educational services, say by organizing schools differently or by using more computers? We didn't get into that question. When we looked at efficiency, we were looking largely at the business costs, which we felt were more, that you were better able to do cross-state comparisons and make a judgment if somebody else is performing this business function more at less cost, that we ought to be able to set that goal. And the other place that we used the comparative analysis was in the areas of just looking at levels of salaries, class size, those kinds of variables. Are our benefits higher than other states? Are our salaries higher than other states? And what's the result on class size? We didn't really look at comparisons of an educational outputs versus how much dollars we were putting into the educational side of the organization. We really were looking more at business costs and then looking at those major input costs of salaries and benefits.
It does, if I may, a follow-up, Madam Chair. And certainly don't need to cover this today, but the reason that this is so important to me and I pose the question is that unlike a business and private enterprise, there are certain things that the government needs to provide, must provide, constitutionally has to provide, or just as a government entity needs to guarantee for its society, rather than just measuring it against the economic factors, the cost. And so the analysis just based on the cost from a business model, in my mind, is very limiting with respect to the obligations that a government may have to its students, parents, or teachers. So that other analysis I'm talking about, if I was clear enough in explaining it, the qualitative analysis, to me is almost more important.
I would agree with that. I think that it was just totally outside of our scope, given the resources and time that we had, to look at all the various ways you might organize instruction. You know, do you have charter schools? Do you have ESDs or not? Do you have more of a, cyber schools or not, and which continue? No, that was just totally outside of our scope. And because there's both finance issues in there as well as instructional, this is an area that there's just a lot of experimentation and knowledge in right now, or in growth and knowledge, and that was just totally outside our scope. But I would agree that that's the important discussion. But that was outside the scope that we had. Okay, let me quickly go through the recommendations. We spent quite a bit of time talking about what the standard of equity ought to be. And there are textbooks written about this. We used one in particular, Ginger is the author, that detailed various standards of equity that one might use to evaluate school funding systems. And ultimately, we settled on the one that is listed here, and I think it is the one that most states have settled on. And I think Brian is the real expert on this kind of thing, and he can probably tell you, the numbers. But I'm not going to go through all the alternative standards. I'm just going to talk about the one we landed on. Which is essentially this, that the system ought to provide a base level of funding. It's called an at least adequate approach. A base level of funding sufficient for students in all districts to achieve the minimum level of performance. And there ought to be adjustments in that base level to account for variations in costs among districts or among schools, and for serving students with special needs or for other kinds of cost differences in performing their functions. That whatever these adjustments are, and these are what you might call the factors in the formula, they ought to be some explicit link to the educational goals of the state. You ought to be able to see that these factors were set based on these being our goals. These are the outcomes we want to achieve. And that having established that base level of funding, that local districts ought to be able to seek additional funding locally for their schools if they choose, which allows local communities to better match their educational service preferences that they may have in that local community. But that even with that ability, that their local ability to raise funds ought to be equalized. In other words, if they're going to ask their local voters for more because that's what they want in their community, then the price ought to be the same in every community. In other words, the amount of tax that you have to levy would get the same yield and additional resources in every community. So you ought to equalize that ability. And that's the standard we ended up with. And I think what you have here is, from an economist's perspective, is something that's very similar to many of the goods that we purchase in our society. Education is a good that, as your income is higher, you typically want to buy more of it. And some communities, their preference for education is higher. There is not one standard of adequacy that everybody agrees to within the state, and some communities want more than others. And if they should be able to buy that if they can, but they shouldn't be able to buy it at a cheaper price because there happens to be a big industrial plant in their community, or a lot of buildings downtown that are really high value. They shouldn't be able to pay a lower price because of that, and so that price ought to be equalized. That's essentially what that standard of equity is. Now, you can use different standards of equity. If you're interested in that, you can have your staff, pull out a textbook and go through those and make your own choice. But that's the standard we agreed to. We believe that having looked at our current formula, that the structure of that formula meets that standard. That's the way that current formula is constructed. Now, there is a question of whether it's adequate or not, whether the funding we're putting into it is adequate or not. That's a whole other piece of our discussion that's in the adequacy section that I'm not going to talk about. But that the structure of that formula will meet the standard that we, maybe not the adequacy part, that's for the debate, but the rest of it meets it. That we did believe that the existing weights and maybe new weights, that the existing weights need to be re-estimated, that the empirical basis for those it's not been as fully explored as it can be, and particularly we have not looked at the links to outcomes. We haven't looked at, and so we went through a whole analysis that that looked particularly at the ESL factor, and at least talked about the kinds of things that you might look at when you try to make a judgment about what that weight ought to be. And then Brian has done a lot of that work, not only for us, but he did a lot of it before as part of his role at the Department of Education. And then this sort of gets to the question Representative Dallin was asking, is that there needs to be feedback loops to constantly revalue these weights and to assess district success in achieving outcomes. So that the way we thought of it is that, okay, now you have a weight, and it says that you're going to allocate additional funds for ESL. And now you're going to look at districts, and are they achieving the goals that the state has set for ESL students, whatever they are. And if you're finding that some districts are achieving them and some are not, that's probably not a level of funding issue. That's probably more of a, you know, some places are better at it than others. And the feedback loop has to tell you that. And you have to have some mechanism for ensuring that those that are not succeeding get help in succeeding. It's probably not a financial issue.
Mr. Scherzinger?
Yes.
So implicit in that statement is that there is not that mechanism currently in place to make that evaluation.
What's implicit in that is, I believe, we have some standards about what we want to achieve. Maybe they're not as complete as they could be, but we're not necessarily drawing the links financially. In other words, we're not re-looking at these factors and saying that, well, what do we really want to achieve here, and what should this factor be if we want to achieve it, and how much should we be giving some districts more than others because they have more ESL students. And we're not looking at, well, are we succeeding with that factor the way it is? In other words, we're not drawing the links between whether we're achieving and what and how much we're putting into it from a financial perspective. And the other thing, by the way, that I haven't talked about is we have recommendations about transparency in the system. That as you, as a legislature, look at the system, you ought to be seeing a lot more information about how much we're spending on particular kinds of students and whether we're getting success in those areas or not. And that's something I haven't talked about. It's the transparency section. And I know there's more work going on in that area. But I think you have to take our recommendations as a whole, at least our work group recommendations. And you can't just do... You wouldn't be able to efficiently do what I just said without doing a lot of the transparency work as well. Without really going in, you've got a $5 billion system, without going in there and say, well, how much are we spending, actually? We know how much, you know, we're giving districts in effect for years. But how much are we spending? What kind of results are we getting for special ed kids, for ESL kids, for poverty kids? How much federal money is going into poverty? Because there's a lot of federal money. A good chunk of the federal money is going into special ed into poverty kids. Well, how much of that, and then what kind of results are we getting? And there's a lot more to the transparency that you need to be looking at, and that will flow out of that, will flow some of the things that I'm talking about here. And those feedback loops essentially are trying to say, well, is it a problem that some districts are not succeeding in this level of funding? We have to find a way to support their work and to help them get to best practices. Or is everybody not succeeding, and therefore maybe that's more likely a financial issue, or they're just not putting enough into it. And then lastly, and this gets to the local option system, we recommended that, and by the way, they told us that we needed to make our recommendations notwithstanding politics. That whether we thought it could be done or not didn't matter. We're going to say what we think. Replace the current local option system. And the problem with the current system is that the gap between Measure 5 and 50 widely varies across the state. And so that even if you equalize funding, that some districts cannot raise their portion of the local option in order to get the equalization grant. And that there's no way to achieve that within the current Measure 550 system, at least the way the local option is constructed under that system. And you needed to replace that with a system that would allow you to do that. And we specified how that would look. And that would take a constitutional change to do that. So those were our recommendations. I don't know if Brian wants to add anything. He really knows the technical detail far better than I do.
Well, for the record, Brian Reeder, Department of Education. One of the great things about working with Jim is that he's so thorough that the rest of us don't have to say anything. But just want to emphasize a couple points, and the first has to do with equity standards. With the Oregon Education Act and now with NCLB at the federal level, we've really gone towards an equity standard that is based on student outcomes, which if you went back 20 or 30 years, I don't think you would really find that to be very explicit. If you go back and look at the court cases in the 70s, they didn't really look at differences in student outcomes. What they looked at was differences in inputs. You know, what was the variation in funding that was observed, and if there was wide variation in funding, they said that's inequitable. You could have, if you had equalized funding but still had very unequal outcomes, that didn't bother the courts at all back then. So it was really an input-based view of what equity meant. Today, I think we've changed our thinking fairly dramatically. We care a lot more today, or we seem to, about equalizing outcomes for students. That's why NCLB looks at subgroups of students broken down by ethnicity, special ed, economically disadvantaged. That's why the federal government cares about those subgroups, because we care about outcome equity, not just input equity. So, if that's what we care about, then our standard of equity that we use in designing an equalization formula needs to be based on outcomes. It needs to consider outcomes, not just the level of inputs, or we're not going to get where we really want to go. And that's the kind of work that we've been trying to do at the department, is not only look at how much money we give to districts, but also what the outcomes they're getting with those resources. And that's sort of what's at the core of our funding formula. We give more money to districts that have students with various special needs. The question is, are we giving them enough to get us towards this outcome equity that we really care about? And that's why the recommendation of the chalkboard was to revisit those weights, to really see if they're devoting the resources to those activities that are required to get us closer to that outcome-based equity notion that we've talked about.
Brian, might I insert here? With the department's concern and emphasis then on what the outcomes are based on how the funds are distributed, the inputs, but there is no requirement that the funds be expended in the area of the inputs. How do you know that those inputs are attaining the desired outcomes?
Well, Chair Flores, I mean, that is a key policy issue. I mean,
I'm just trying to connect the dots.
Right. I mean, and I think Jim alluded to this earlier, is that given that the circumstances of different districts vary tremendously, it's very hard for a central body like the legislature or the Department of Education to say you must spend your money this way because it may not fit their circumstances. the department continues to believe that holding them to performance standards is the best way to achieve that goal, not telling them how to spend their money. Having said that, though, if we think that, just as an example, ESL students require additional funding in order to get them to a performance level that we think is appropriate, and the funding formula does not provide that additional level of funding, then it's very hard for us to say to a district, well, you didn't meet the standard, when we haven't given them enough resources to meet the standard. So you need to know what the additional cost is and what the additional resource requirements are to get them there, even if you don't tell them how to spend it. I mean, it's like, if my income is not enough to buy the kind of house I want, telling me to buy that house without increasing my income isn't going to make it happen. So they need the resources to get where we want them to go, even if we don't explicitly tell them how they have to spend them.
And so what I would say to that is two things. At sort of a quick level, I'd say that it's a function of how you want to hold districts accountable. Mm-hmm. And there are various ways of doing that, and that we responded that you need to have these feedback loops. You need to have the ability to identify who wasn't succeeding given the funding that they had, and have supports for them, whether it's, you know, helping them get to best practices, whatever it is, that was a more effective way of assuring that everybody's using best practices than mandating that funds be spent in a particular way, given the differences that exist among districts and among students. I think the more general way to respond would be, and this is, I'm going to do a little economist speak here, it really has to do with what you believe your production function to be. What is the method of production that is giving you the outcomes that you want? And that our understanding of that, and it really goes through our whole discussion, is that it's a professional model. That is, that the way to achieve the outcomes we want is to have the person who is on the front lines, who is delivering the service, be a professional who understands that children learn differently, that they all come from a different place, and can modify their instruction to meet the needs of each individual child. But that's a professional person, and that you need a system that supports that level of professionalism on the front line, and you need principals that can support that, which means professional principals that have that ability to make decisions based on their professional knowledge, and you need to have district staff, central staff, that can support that level of professionalism. And if that kind of model is not one in which it's not a factory model, and that means that has implications for the compensation systems that you use. It has implications for how you allocate funds and what kind of freedom that you give to people, and how you hold them accountable for the results that you want. And that we believe that kind of feedback loop system and not specifying specifically how each dollar is going to be spent was more consistent with that kind of professional model of how you want to get your results. Now, if you don't believe that's the model that we ought to be using, you could come to a very different conclusion.
Madam Chair, yeah. When you're done. Thank you. And the very last part of what you said is what intrigues me so much about the entire direction we go with this funding, this outcomes-based funding model. And it goes back, too, to my comment earlier about some type of qualitative analysis. Because when we're talking about outcomes-based, we're really talking primarily, correct me if I'm wrong, about standardized testing results in certain areas, mostly those that are required by the No Child Left Behind Act. And by that standard, a district like mine in the Beaverton district, you know, does pretty well. And we would view it as being a successful model based on those standards. But if you do more of an analysis of what's really going on there, what you'll see is a lot of shifting and emphasis towards those areas that are tested in order to give the appearance of success, when in fact you've got a district that has eliminated all of its apprenticeship programs, virtually all of its shop classes, virtually all of its elementary music programs, all of the middle school athletic programs are gone, and I would have a very difficult time when we are linking a funding model, outcomes-based, to a judgment of success in how you best raise and teach a child, as to whether or not what we are solely doing is just trying to find an easy way to hold somebody accountable for the money we're giving them, as opposed to ensuring whether or not we're raising and teaching well-rounded children. So my comment earlier about looking at more of a qualitative analysis is saying, where are we taking into account how we're raising a whole human being, as opposed to how we're just trying to hold an administrator easily accountable for the $1 million we give them? And feel free to comment on that if you want, but that's the link I see missing in all of our analysis on funding.
I would agree absolutely with that. But what I would say is the reason that we're using the test that we're using is not because they're a full specification of what we want. It's that that's what we can afford. And if you want a better test, it's going to cost more money, less money.
Talk more about that. I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, what I mean is if you want to fully specify exactly what you want, not only I tend to view the standards we have as a set of minimum standards that we want everyone to achieve. And Brian may have a slightly different view of that, because I think sometimes we get into discussions, but that's the way I view them. And that if we really wanted to fully specify, you know, whether it's character or citizenship or all the other outputs we might want out of our students, and we fully specified exactly what we wanted, and we developed a mechanism to fully sort of test or assess, I guess is a better word, of whether we're achieving those results, that's a bigger investment than we're making right now. And now I do believe that you can integrate assessments into instruction, and by integrating it all the way down, you know, so that it's part and parcel of what a teacher does. It's not just an extra thing on the top of things. It's that the whole system is integrated in that way. I think there are efficiencies to that. But nonetheless, it's a bigger investment than we're making now. But you want a better product, you're going to have to make more investment. That's what I believe. And if you fully specified what it took to get there, and I think that's a lot of work. It's an area that really there's a lot that education research can't tell you right now.
One more, Madam Chair, and then I'll be finished. Thank you. Yeah. I know this is a discussion about formula, the structure of a formula, and not funding in general. But the formula, it seems to be, must accommodate providing in all those different areas, or what you end up doing over time is winnowing down your goals and expectations in order to simply accommodate the formula. And I think some of what you've provided here does show a broader path, you know, there's equalization notions and things like this. I'm not so sure the formula that we're using lends itself to the broader funding that we need in order to accomplish all the things we just talked about.
The formula is a mathematical formula, will not tell you the level of funding that you need. It doesn't purport to do that and never will do that. And so it is dividing the funds up. And so there is a much broader discussion that is appropriate, especially at your level, as to what goals you want to achieve and how you as the few people on top of a big, huge system are going to achieve those goals and how you're going to hold the system accountable. And the funding system is just one piece of that.
I guess Chair Flores, Representative Locking, I would add one thing to that, and it goes back to this recommendation by Chalkboard, which essentially says the funding formula would provide a floor, and then local districts would have the ability to raise additional revenue on top of that. And that what's really driving that, two things driving that. First of all, that different communities have different tastes or different preferences for the level of education that they want, and that they ought to be able to get that if they choose to. Some people respond to that by saying, well, don't you get inequities if you allow them to raise more money, because some will raise a lot and some will raise a little. And my response would be, well, yes, but equity is not our only goal here. We have other goals, and one of those goals is to give people what they want, giving the citizens of Oregon what they want. The current funding formula we have now basically does not allow communities to raise any more money in a meaningful way. Just as an example, we have one district that, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which district it is, that went out and passed a local option without looking very carefully at how much money they could raise with it, and they ended up raising $24 with their local option.
That's a big boost. Representative Wisner.
And I believe the reason that happened is that our property tax system is so complicated that they didn't understand the situation they were facing. But back to Jim's comment, he's right. The distribution formula says nothing really about what we want in terms of our educational outcomes. That's a different discussion. My belief is that primarily NCLB, by focusing and forcing us to focus on standardized test scores, has narrowed our vision about what's important. And, you know, to the extent that the state is forced to adopt that narrower vision to meet the requirements of the federal government, and to the extent that we essentially disallow local communities to raise additional money if they want to, the result is exactly what you're describing. We're not forced to.
The 14th Amendment, we can choose to disregard it and provide our own system if we want.
Representative Avakian.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
A very legitimate discussion. I know where you're going with it.
But if we are to do that, it would require a change in our funding structure to make that happen.
Absolutely.
Representative Wisnett, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Berger asked if I was going to sit out in front and talk about this. My first session, I came in and I had a couple of bills and I've learned a lot about the school distribution form. And I appreciate the comments that were made by the representatives of the school board and the teachers that, you know, I think it probably does work overall, but there's some things that don't quite seem fair. My phantom student bill that I introduced with Mr. Ritter, Brian's help, Ryder's help, Ritter's help, is like $116 million over two sessions or 2 years that are being given to kids that are not in the classroom. Okay, and I've understood and I've had all the presentations given to me about why we need to glide down and all these things. And, of course, you know, we talked today, I forgot who it was, that two-thirds of our schools now have declining enrollment. Mr. Rose is not here, and that's what I was trying to establish. When the school formula was created, we didn't have two-thirds of our schools having declining enrollment. And it's now almost become the norm, except for a few counties and a few schools. And the biggest school district with declining enrollment is the Portland School District, which last session, I think, last year had 3,000. I see in the paper this year they've got another 2,600 declining enrollment. And that money to those schools keeps stair-stepping. I had the high-growth bill, which I had more support from, I think, most of the people on this committee, but I only had 21 votes out of 60 wouldn't do it. So just, again, the declining enrollment schools versus the schools that are paying more than their 30% of the 70-30 mix. My school district's outside of Brothers is 70-30 and 50-50 and about 60-40. But I've learned after my first session, you can't change the world. You have to sort of compromise and negotiate. And I still think the phantom student is an area that we can change with a school distribution formula and not be that difficult. My suggestion, and Brian, would you please look at this so we can talk together. I do think that the high cost disability, Madam Chair, I think I would support an actual cost reimbursement on that. know, that's something the school shouldn't have to pay. That should, if they're losing, is it $9 million or $90 million, they shouldn't have to lose that. I think we should look at the transportation grant and look at the incentives program so that goes. But what I would propose, and I'd ask Brian's expertise on this, all we have to do in the current formula is use ADM when we're looking at declining enrollment. In other words, take all of the factors that go into the weighted student and put that after you determine the declining enrollment. Because what we're doing with declining enrollment, you know, if a school had a student who was pregnant this year and she's not there next year, you're getting paid two students, not one student. So my proposal would be that we do the declining enrollment, whether you accept, you know, whether you use the 2004-2005 in the handout I gave you, or the or 2004 or 2000, or the previous year, you would actually use just the ADM before you decide how you're going to do the declining enrollment. That's going to be, like in the example I gave you, that's 1,000 less students. The Redmond School District, the ADM was 6,000, but the ADW was 7,000. So you're working with 1,000 less students. Now, the declining enrollment, of course, is not that much, but it's going to reduce the impact of those schools that are subsidizing the other two-thirds schools. And you're paying for the actual student, not the weighted student. Does Mr. Reeder have any comments on that?
Chair Flores, Representative Wisner, if I understand what you're proposing is that right now the system says if you had 1,000 more weighted students last year than you have this year, we're gonna fund you on those 1,000 students. But if we base it on ADM, that 1,000 may only be 500. So we're still going to give you funding for an additional 500 students, but not an additional 1,000 students.
Yes.
Is that right?
Basically, yes.
Okay.
It could go the other way, though.
Yeah, conceivably, it could go the other way. The change in ADM from one year to the next could be larger than the change in ADMW from one year to the next, depending on which... Yeah. Which students we're talking about.
But you're actually then looking at a student, one student.
Right.
That occupies one desk, that occupies, you know. So.
That's correct.
And I think the formula on the page we're looking at, down to the block where it says 2004-2005 general purpose grant, you would have the eight, you know, just you change it around the format so you would have an ADM plus the weighted part of it. And that way we can also then go to where we look at general purpose grant. I would like to see that we put in there per actual student, ATM versus ADMW. I think that, again, because of the transparency issue I talked about before, I think those are just cleanup things, but I think it will save, it will reduce some of the money going to schools, but it's fair. It's actual students, not more students than they're actually declining enrollment in. Any comments, Ben?
Chair Flores, Representative Wisnett, I think two issues there. One is sort of changing the nature of how many students we pay for in declining enrollment districts, but the other has to do with reporting this information in a clearer way. I think part of the confusion here is that we talk about weighted students as though they're real students, and they're not. These are not students. They are some abstract idea known as a weight. So rather than talking about weighted students, maybe we ought to talk about weights, because they're not real people. They are simply a mechanism to give more money to districts that have students with special needs. So I think our terminology may be getting in the way here. In terms of reporting on these kinds of documents, the amounts per actual student rather than the amounts per weighted student or per weight, if that's useful, we can certainly do that for you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, so then what I would propose, if I can have the assistance of Brian at maybe the next committee meeting, we could bring back the changes that we have to do to maybe follow this suggestion.
I will coordinate that with Mr. Keller and pursue that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative.
Yeah, if you'll indulge me to ask Representative Wisnett to make it clear in my mind exactly what the goal is here. Is the goal to take an unfairness out of the system that is directed at increasing enrollment, so therefore then redistribute more equitably the whole... It isn't to reduce the cost, it's to more equitably redistribute within the formula. I guess I'm not clear what your goal is here.
Gotcha.
Representative?
Thank you, Representative. It's fairness. I mean, our school is helping other schools, and I want to help schools. That's what the equity, and I understand all the principles. I also talked to enough teachers and superintendents that, you know, I understand the glide down when you have declining enrollment, but that glide down is continuing, just like in Portland schools. It never stops. It's not a 1 year or 2 years, and that runs out. You know, having every year. So I just think it's not creating more money, and it's but we've been benefiting the schools with declining enrollment, and it comes out of our pocket, the schools that are more than 30% in the state.
Someone, did you have any final wrap up comments for us?
No.
Sorry to have interrupted you there, Brian. I know that took us down another trail, but thank you. Thank you very much. And it was good to have you both and all of you here. Having lost a substitute portion of our committee, I guess that brings us to the end of our day. Thank you all. And an announcement, please. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our House Revenue Chair just asked me to remind the Revenue Committee that we will meet on November 22nd and for the forecast release. And the other issue on the agenda will be local finance issues. So we'll be working on that agenda to get that to you the next week.
Thank you very much. We'll stand adjourned.